What a piece of luck. We start our election campaign today.
Elections? In this place?
Of course, we make our choice every 12 months. Every citizen has a choice. Are you going to run?
Like blazes, the first chance I get.
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock, and welcome to the COVID Secure, not the BCFM, politics show on Friday the 3rd of September 2021. We're streaming live once more from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, no longer in the wilds of North Norfolk in Bristol, and at radioquk.com in Camberley, Surrey. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Tonight, Derry's at Dr. Anne McCloskey. She says the NHS is not being overwhelmed, it's being dismantled, and she's been defrocked for her trouble speaking out. Nothing to do, of course, with the fact that she's an outspoken GP on the nationalist side of the Northern Ireland divide. So we'll be hearing from her an absolutely outspoken cry, talking about what's going on as evil. And the Freedom Network, groups of lockdown sceptics and vaccine intelligent right across the UK, and an excellent weekly email newsletter. We hear from one of the founders of the Freedom Network, Karen Dodd. But first, Kabul airport bomb. That's what we're going to be talking about straight away, I think. And also, of course, in New Zealand, we just heard this morning. The home of the lone wolf, it seems. These terrorist attacks that seem to be carried out by lunatics, nutters, people that the intelligence services groom even for potential attacks like this. Why on earth is this guy allowed to just wander around with a squad following him closely, just in case he does something like this, maybe? And also, James Files, the assassin of JFK, the hitman brought down from Chicago to kill the President Kennedy back in 1963. He's out of jail. Also, ex-UN military advisor The Saker discusses Israel with Pink Floyd's Roger Waters. But our main item tonight will be looking at what Afghanistan was really all about. Just about as far away from the USA as you can get. So what is the point? Maybe that is the point, that it is so far away from the US. This is a part of the world that otherwise the US couldn't control. Also, like the 1960s and 70s Vietnam War, the opium poppy eradication is just a word. The production of poppy skyrocketed, as did funds for mafia black operations across the globe, and, of course, deaths due to heroin. We get the expert opinion you won't see or hear anywhere in the London media. The former US Marine Corps intelligence colonel and UN Iraq weapons inspector who resigned when his work was abused and misused by the CIA, that's Scott Ritter. And also here in Bristol, the Labour Bristol cabinet member Helen Godwin, who always refused over the last 5 years to appear on this show, wouldn't even pick up the phone to me. She was one of the two or three people on the cabinet that just absolutely refused to be interviewed. Well, guess what? She's taken a jump to PricewaterhouseCoopers, straight from the Bristol cabinet. Supposedly a politician. Actually, maybe. She's been working with these finance people all the time. Censorship and self-censorship of life-saving information is sadly the norm in the UK today, thanks to the big pharma profiteer collaborators who own the transmitters and the printing presses of the Fourth Industrial Revolution's Fourth Reich. So, if you can restream us live or rebroadcast us, just let me know and we'll credit you here. Now, joining me is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Hi, Martin. You've had a few weeks, actually, away up in Herefordshire. How's your holiday from school been?
Well, it's obviously a holiday from having to go to work in the mornings, and I've made the most of it, but I was back in school today.
So just give us an idea of what's the situation in our schools at the moment. There's all this talk, isn't there, at the moment about getting vaccine, COVID, they call them vaccines, whether they're actually some sort of genetic therapy is another thing, into children, isn't there? Any talk about that at school?
No, I mean, we weren't talking about anything like that. I mean, obviously, the regime in schools has changed quite dramatically from the end of last term, because at the end of last term, all the kids were in bubbles, and anybody who was testing positive, then, the bubble was popped, and they all had to go home. We're now back more like school, in theory, more like schools used to run. There won't be any bubbles anymore. And unless there is a massive surge in infections, then we're not going to be having people sent home. But we're not clear, because obviously what happened previously is things were said, we were going to do it like this. And then, you know, what happened last Christmas was we all went back for one day so that everybody could spread COVID, and then we all went home again.
That is if there really was much COVID being spread.
Well, I think the COVID was being spread before Christmas, but the government decided that they were going to get everybody back in school, and then they were overruled, and then they decided to backtrack. So that doesn't suggest they're very competent either way round, does it, Tony?
Well, I don't know. I think maybe it's just that the policy is actually not being made by the government. It's being made by these little big pharmaceutical people at Sage and these policy advisors. So, of course, they're beholden to the pharmaceutical industry.
In actual fact, Sage have been saying we shouldn't go back at all. And of course,
that's what you'd expect.
Well, it is what you'd expect. And of course, they'd also been saying that we need lockdowns. And of what the Tory
sounds like what you're saying.
Yes, I'm just making that point, Tony. The Tory party has got a very strident right wing who very much got to the front bench by the short and curlies, and they've always been opposed to lockdowns. So there's been a battle between them and the scientific advisors at every stage of this.
Good.
Of this
so at least someone's fighting those pharmaceutical representatives who have managed to infiltrate the policies.
Yes, but Tony, pharmaceutical representatives and vaccines are completely different from lockdowns. Not the same thing at all, as you just said.
They want lockdowns. They still want lockdowns.
No.
These people.
Listen, Tony, you're creating straw men and then
destroying. No, I'm not. Just answer the question. Rather than trying to make personal points, why don't you just answer the point, which is let's absolutely make it clear: the pharmaceutical industry want lockdowns, and they are in the driving seat when it comes to policy at groups like NerveTag and Sage.
It's not just the pharmaceutical industry who want lockdowns, Tony. The pharmaceutical industry may want lockdowns because they want to push vaccines, but that's another step. Lockdowns have been put in place in places like China where they don't have Western big pharma at all. They definitely do not decide the policy in Beijing. They absolutely don't. And the people who've been pushing for lockdowns here in this country, like John Campbell, who I saw his stuff this week, he's actually saying that ivermectin might be worthwhile, but he's also saying we want vaccines and we believe in lockdowns. And of course, in actual fact, in terms of public opinion, it's always been clear that people wanted more strict lockdowns rather than less. There's a very significant minority that didn't want that, including people like Tim Martin and the other pro-Brexit wing of the Tory party. They have actually been able to dominate policy at every stage, so that we've gone into lockdowns too late every single time,
so
and then released
rather,
it too early.
You'd much rather we were still part of the EU and somewhere like France, where there's all sorts of civil unrest now being caused by the imposition of things like vaccine
all
passports.
Right, well,
this is all, of course, a pharmaceutical industry agenda.
No, it's not, Tony. Everything doesn't come back to Big Pharma. There is also international politics. There's also the collapse of the financial services sector. There's also 9/11 and what you might call terrorism, which is actually much more important for understanding what the deep state does than the machinations of Big Pharma in the West. Because, of course, Sinopharm and the Sputnik vaccine and the Cuban vaccines have got nothing to do with Western Big Pharma at all. Nothing. Zero. Zilch. The issues about what we do about COVID in this country have been completely...
Is this COVID going to carry on forever like the good old 9/11 war on terror?
I think it quite likely will, Tony, because once you release a biological agent into the general population, you're in a difficult position, aren't you?
Well, you certainly are, especially when you're vaccinating people, and many people are dying of vaccines too, and then that's all getting a little bit confused as to what people are dying of. One thing's for sure is that the original... people who were dying of COVID, certainly that was very much happening back in the spring last year. But there seems to be a lot of evidence to me around that now we're looking at very, very few deaths due to COVID, and most of the problems with the health service being overwhelmed are actually to do with the health service being dismantled by the Tories.
I totally agree with that. They are dismantling it, and they're using COVID as a disaster capitalist opportunity to do exactly that. But that doesn't change the politics of what happened last year, Tony, whereas we went into lockdowns too late every time and released too early every time. Eat out to help
well,
out
your
was
view.
Eat out to spread out. And you've got a different view.
This is your view, yes. We know. You keep repeating this whole Rishi Sunak thing. Actually,
are you in favour of Rishi Sunak's policy?
The evidence...
Did you think it was the right thing to do?
Martin, are you going to let me finish a sentence, or are you just going to keep interrupting for the next 3 hours?
Are we going to talk about Afghan bombs, or are we going to talk about all of this?
Well, we're going to be talking about both, actually, right. As I think you know. But you're just trying to interrupt in order to interrupt my questions, which is really rather a cheap rhetorical trick, the sort of thing we'd expect from a rather dirty politician. But anyway, let me finish the sentence, which is about the initial reaction to COVID and also Rishi Sunak's policy. If you have a look at the results after Eat Out to Help Out was finished, there was no great increase at all in excess deaths. And so all this stuff about, there was a report out saying, oh dear, look, this has caused a lot of trouble. But there's much more evidence, the long-term evidence, is that there are absolutely no difference whatsoever.
Well, I don't see how you can say that, Tony. In actual fact, people like you, Toby Young, actually went on.
Can we just stop personalising this?
All right, let's not personalise.
You love personalising things. I want to talk about the issues.
Okay, let's talk.
You
want
to talk about me and why I am wrong. Let's just talk about the issues and why they are wrong.
Let's talk about the issues then. It's pretty clear to me and to most of the British population that at the beginning of the crisis, we've got a speech that Boris Johnson made at the Royal Naval College in Greenwich, saying that at least one country is going to try and go for herd immunity.
Well, they did.
It's on the record.
They did. It's Sweden.
Yes. They didn't go for herd immunity. They went for limited lockdown. Boris Johnson.
Well, this is a very similar
thing. We've also got it actually proven that he said, let the bodies pile high. Those were his exact words. Right. We've got several people saying it. We're not going back into lockdown. Then he had to go back into lockdown because in actual fact, the death rate rose. You on this show.
Hang on. We're personalising again, aren't we? Here we go. Yeah, go on.
All right. Toby Young actually put his hand up on Newsnight because people were saying there is no second wave. And they were proved wrong. There was a second wave. And if you're going to deny that there was a second wave, I just don't know what to do, Tony, because there was a second wave. Mm. And people were saying there will be no second wave. We had Alan here saying, but there's no second wave. And there was a second wave. And if you keep saying there was no second wave, and all we should do is you should let it flow through the population.
You personalise it again
aren't
you?
Toby Young saying that. Yeah, let's let it flow through the whole population. Yeah. Boris Johnson saying
it
that.
It has pretty much
flowed
through
and we've had hundreds of thousands of people dead. Unlike in China, where it's less than 5,000.
Yes, and those people didn't need to die because there are all sorts of treatments which were prevented, weren't there?
Yes, but we didn't know that at the time, did we?
Well, we were talking about it here. Yes. I'm thinking October last year.
Yes,
we started talking.
Actually, it was even earlier.
It was early as May, wasn't it? Where Trump was talking about, this is May 2020, where Trump was talking about chloroquine.
He was talking about bleach as well, wasn't he?
He was poo-pooed, talking about chloroquine.
He talked about bleach as well, Tony. Don't forget, he mentioned
Trump
in the same street.
Donald Trump was talking about chloroquine. And
bleach.
Donald Trump was talking about chloroquine back in May 2020, which is a very, very definite treatment which can stop people going into hospital. But that was prevented by who? By the pharmaceutical industry and by the lockdown lunatics, the people that just want to lock everything down and go for zero COVID. Now, that obviously, quite obviously, has not worked in New Zealand, has it?
It has worked in New Zealand. They've got a reducing death rate now.
It hasn't.
They will be back on program
because
very soon enough.
Any time they can have another wave, because they've tried to stop what is basically a modern type of or new type of flu virus, which is going to go around the population anyway, and they've tried to say, "Oh, it's never going to come here." This is like King Canute trying to stop the sea coming in.
I think what you're going to find as we go forward, Tony, and I make a firm prediction on this. COVID will not come back to New Zealand as long as they stick to the policies they've pursued. We, on the other hand, quite possibly will have another wave and we may be back in lockdown before you know it.
If the New Zealanders decide they want to treat their people, then they will have another wave, but it will hardly kill anybody. That's the best way to deal with it.
Well, what they're going for is to vaccinate everybody before they open up.
That's the pharmaceutical industry agenda, isn't it?
Well, it is,
anyway,
but not in China.
Let's have a little listen to this week's Star Doctor. And I think we've probably got a bit less this week because I've been so busy getting the yurt back from North Norfolk and sorting that out, etc. A bit less in the way of time and in the way of interviews. But we'll start this week with a woman from Derry. She's called Dr. Anne McCloskey, and she's been saying that the National Health Service has not been overwhelmed. It's being dismantled. I just thought her take on all of this was absolutely fascinating, to see there's somebody here who's been at the front line for the last 20 years, an Irish nationalist, we'll call her, not a Catholic, but working in Derry, and really at the cutting edge to see what's going on. And she is very, very concerned about these COVID vaccines. She's seeing all sorts of reactions, particularly in young people, as of course people have been coerced into taking this vaccine, you know, for all sorts of reasons, like if they want to travel, they trust the MHRA that it's safe, even though the emergency use authorization for these vaccines was falsified. And in fact, there's a challenge to that, I believe, a judicial review going in from Lawyers for Liberty this week. I've not heard anything about that, so I'd like to have reported on it. If anyone's got any info on it, please send it in via my email, which is on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. So a judicial review to say that this emergency use authorization of the vaccine was unlawful, because there are treatments for COVID, and it was all based on the fact that there was no treatment for COVID. So let's have a listen now to Dr. Anne McCloskey from Derry.
Hello everybody, this is Anne McCloskey here, and I'm making this wee video in my back room in my home here in Derry. I work as a GP locally, and this may be a bit incoherent and kind of stream of consciousness, but it's because I'm really upset and angry, and distraught wouldn't be too strong a word. I've just come in from a shift in the Out of Irish GP Centre. I worked until midnight last night, and I worked again from 8 o'clock this morning until 12 o'clock. And during that time, I dealt with very many sick, distressed, worried, traumatised people. Almost all of them, with the exception of small children, have been double jabbed. They've had two injections of an experimental genetic therapy. Having been advised in some cases, but in other cases coerced, bribed or bullied because of removal of their human rights and basic privileges, such as to travel or to meet with their friends and family. So they've accepted these things in good faith. Very many of them. I mean, I saw very little else this morning. This time last year, I've been working since the beginning of this COVID crisis. I retired as a GP 2 years ago, and I went back to work at in April of last year. And this time last year, there was nothing happening. I mean, nothing. This year, it's different. The hospitals are full, and our place, the Out of Irish, is jammed with people who are testing positive for in the PCR test, and yet who've had two doses of injections. The other thing I am seeing in increasing numbers, and it's so distressful to even think about it because I know that they're coming after the children next, but I'm seeing young people, healthy, previously fit young people who are damaged. God forbid that it's irreparably, but I saw a girl this week who had a clot in her upper arm. A teenager. I have, in 40 years in medicine, I have never, ever seen an upper arm clot in a healthy young person. But worse, she was told by the consultant at the hospital and by her own doctor, oh, no, 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 this is nothing to do with the fact that it happened the first week after your second injection. No, no, you must have hurt yourself at the gym. This girl's fit and slim and healthy and active. I saw this morning, or rather I spoke to, a young man who has been unable to get out of bed now for 2 weeks since taking his injection. Again, told by a GP whom he trusts that, oh, that's it, working, you're going to set up a really good immune response. The fact that you're absolutely floored and can't get on with your normal life is normal after an immunisation. This is a lie. In between, I spoke to people. I spoke to a woman who's caring for her mother in her 90s and a brother who has a trisomy and his Down syndrome. And although she understands that this is largely illusory, this whole hype has largely been a figment of the media and the government and their lying scientific advisors' deceptions, she took the two jags for the sake of the people she loves, for her mother who's in her 90s and for her brother who is doing something, and she is sick. She's not well. People have no expectation of help. I, last week, was the only GP covering Derry, Limavady, Strabane, right down as far as Omagh, Newton Stewart, Castlederg, for large parts of Sunday. It's not good enough. Our NHS is being dismantled. It's not overwhelmed. It's being dismantled in front of our eyes. The GPs don't seem to be available to work in the out-of-hour centre. I hear that they're busy elsewhere. And I am not sleeping at night worried about what these injections are doing, because they're certainly not improving the health and well-being of the community that I am proud and privileged to serve. We've been at this for a year now, those of us who see and look at the data, look at the real-world data, not the computer models generated by people who are bought and sold by billionaires and trillionaires and people who have massive conflicts of interest in the outcomes of all of this. We who look at real-world data and have been studying this from the beginning can see that this is not about health. These injections are doing real harm. They are certainly not providing any visible protection for people. And they are still in clinical trials for another 2 years. They are unlicensed and unapproved. They have emergency use authorisation on the premise of the false assumption that there are no other treatments available for COVID. And I've been reading the molecular biology around these things, and it is chilling to understand at subcellular level the potential harms they may have. Now, I hope I am wrong. I sincerely hope I am wrong, because we know that there are millions, millions of our fellow humans who have already subjected themselves to this therapy in good faith. You know, people who are decent, good people and who want to look after their communities. And they've been lied to. And I sincerely hope that our worst fears are not going to be fulfilled. But this must stop. And as I say, we have been arguing for a year. We've been doing stuff on social media. We've been having rallies and protests. And they make us feel good, but they're not changing anything. We need to get into these communities and we need to stop this. We need to get the information out. People are being harmed and people are dying. If you look at the MHRA data, and it's not being analysed at all, there's over 1,500 deaths so far in the UK. And I am telling you, I filled out 4 MHRA yellow card forms this morning. And I think that's probably, it's difficult to know, but I have never spoken to another doctor locally who even knows how to do it. And they're difficult to fill out. It takes 10 to 15 minutes. They are incredibly complicated and, I would contend, deliberately difficult to fill out. And it's a very frustrating and slow process, even when you've been doing them fairly regularly, as I have. So I want you to share this video. I want to be wrong. I want to be the conspiracy theorist that people say I am. But I said a year ago, publicly in my hometown, that these people wanted to vaccinate the 7.8 billion people on this planet. I was told that, I said that they were going to not let us out of lockdowns and not let us have our lives back again until that was achieved. I was called a lunatic. I was called a fantasist. I was called a tinfoil hat wearer by none other than our esteemed health minister. But everything I said, unfortunately, has come true. I want to be wrong. I would cheerfully deal with the ridicule and the opprobrium for the rest of my days. It wouldn't bother me. And I would take one of these vaccines. In fact, all 4 or whatever number of them are. I would take one every hour, on the hour, in all my 4 limbs, if they would leave our children alone. I want you to talk to people. I want you to inform yourselves. I want you to understand that the only people standing between psychopathy and our beautiful children and young people are the adults. It's us who have to act. And I'm not talking about rallies, and I'm not talking about bitching on social media about what's going on and about one another. I'm talking about getting out there. I have leaflets available. I'm going to get posters made like the David Clues has in England to stand at traffic junctions and let people see that these injections are killing people. They are harming people. They are not preventing sickness and they are not about health. Now, I haven't written the playbook for what is going on, but I know it's malevolent and I know that it must be stopped. And if we don't stop it, who's going to? Thank you.
It's Dr. Anne McCloskey there from Derry in Northern Ireland. Martin, so one of your natural colleagues, I suppose, she would be happy sitting down chatting with nationalists and Republicans on the Catholic side of the debate. But what do you make of what you heard there?
Well, I think the questions are open about whether these vaccines are A, effective or B, dangerous. Well, I don't think that's...
Okay, so surely it's not open if you've got somebody there who's at the cut. I mean, she's saying...
No, those are anecdotal.
The thing is, it's not anecdotal. It's her talking about her direct experience. I mean, it's...
That's
you can't
anecdotal,
get any,
Tony.
You can't get any better than that, actually.
It's anecdotal.
It's not anecdotal. It's her talking about her direct experience, right? And that's in
what
the real,
anecdotal
that's
means.
In, that's in the real world. Right?
Yes.
So we've got all these computer models. We've got lots of people, particularly people with a political axe to grind or profits to make, having all sorts of models and theories. But she's actually at the front line.
Yes. And she may have a strong case to make and she's trying to make it. But the point is, there's other people who
should
don't
she
agree
be,
with her.
Should she be allowed to make it?
Well, she's made it. But there's other people who don't agree with her. Who've got similar qualifications to her.
Well, I'll tell you who doesn't agree with her, and that is the, as a headline, just a day or so after that video was made, Dr. Anne McCloskey, GP, suspended over COVID-19 vaccine comments. Although, actually, she didn't call them vaccines, she called them treatments, which is absolutely right. They're not traditional vaccines, they're a completely new type of so-called vaccine. They're called vaccines, but they're not vaccines. A Derry GP has been suspended for comments she made about the COVID-19 vaccination programme. Dr. Anne McCloskey, a former councillor, expressed concern in a social media video about young people being given the COVID-19 vaccine. The Health and Social Care Board said it was suspending her as a precautionary measure while it undertakes a full investigation. She cannot work for the National Health Service during that time. They said the suspension was not an automatic occurrence when undertaking an investigation, so they could have investigated her and not suspended her. In the 9-minute video posted on Sunday, Dr. McCloskey made a number of claims, including there was not enough evidence that it was safe to young people for young people to be vaccinated.
That was one of the claims that she made, indeed.
So if there isn't enough evidence, do you think there is enough evidence that young people can be safely vaccinated?
Well, at the moment, as I understand it, the position of the British government is that children under 16 will not be vaccinated. So in a sense, all of this huffing and puffing about whether they're going to vaccinate children, it's not even on the table.
Well, of course it's on the table because they're about to decide whether to vaccinate them or not. I mean, what she's trying to do is to try and make sure they don't before they do. And also she's saying that she's seeing a lot of young people in her various surgeries, etc., who've got inexplicable ailments. Anyway, she said young people were being coerced, bribed or bullied into being vaccinated and that vaccines were malevolent. And then the BBC go on to say there is no evidence to support Dr. McCloskey's comments. Well, of course, there is evidence. It's not just her. There are hundreds of doctors across the world who are saying similar sorts of things about vaccines causing harm. In fact, potentially much more harm than the good they're supposed to be doing. And one thing that the BBC or the HSCB can't get around is that this whole thing is a human experiment.
I think nobody denies that because of the problems with lockdowns, we wanted to get the vaccines out there as quick as possible.
Well, the lack of treatment, the supposed lack of treatment. Yeah.
But don't forget, when this started off, nobody knew what it was. So you know, we started off with a knowledge base about this, which is quite limited. You say thousands of doctors all over the world are saying that the vaccines are you know dangerous. There are many more thousands who are saying get vaccinated. Are they all wrong?
She was talking about one there who was saying if you've got a blood clot in your upper arm where you got a jab, that means you probably just hurt yourself at the gym.
That's anecdotal. But the fact is that far more doctors say get vaccines than the minority who say don't. Now, if you're not a doctor, at what point do you decide? she might be right, but then the other doctors who are outnumber her say that she's wrong. So there you have it.
Yeah, it depends if these doctors are just simply doing what they've been asked to do in order to keep their careers, because she's now lost her career at the NHS.
Yes, and it could be that there's a big conspiracy behind it all by Big Pharma. I could agree with that, but I think it's more to do with geopolitics and that COVID itself is a bioweapon. And, of course, in China, they got rid of it without any vaccines at all by doing lockdowns properly.
The other thing, of course, is this whole dismantling of the health service. She's saying that patients that she knows in Derry have got no expectation of getting any help anymore.
Well, the disaster capitalism surrounding COVID is pretty clear to everybody. Now, it's possible that it's a natural virus which evolved naturally and the disaster capitalists have just jumped all over it. I'm more of the opinion that it's a deliberate attack originally designed to trash the Chinese economy and the global economy on the behalf of the financial elites which control the pharmaceutical companies. But then if you're dealing with something like that, it's not just one thing, is it? It's lots of other things meshed in with it.
She's also talking about psychopaths, people pushing this stuff. I mean, Martin, are you a psychopath?
No, I don't think so.
That's me getting personal now. But look, I mean, she's saying it's malevolent. She's saying it's malevolent.
Well, I could agree with her that it is malevolent, because if you develop a biological warfare agent and attempt to poison people with it and then bring a vaccine forward to try and supposedly deal with it, which is actually also part of your plan, then that's malevolence. But 9/11 was malevolent, wasn't it? And the attack on China would be similar to 9/11.
Most people think, well, nobody would ever want to do something nasty and evil as that.
They would. There's every reason why they do that. Because the elite, the people are focusing too much on the pharmaceutical companies here. The pharmaceutical companies are run by the banks, and the banks run the military. And it's ultimately the people with money behind all of this. The pharmaceutical companies are simply a part of the problem.
Well, it does seem to me that the banks these days run the whole show. They just decide Indeed. Where the money's going to go. If they find some eugenics lunatic in, say, for example, the Wellcome Trust, they will shovel as much money as they possibly can at them if they happen to be eugenicists too. I mean, one of the other things she was saying there, which seems a little bit ridiculous, I mean, how can she be saying to be bringing the profession into disrepute by the regulators when actually the health minister has said for expressing views, and this is previous views she's expressed, not as extreme as what we just heard there, that she's a tinfoil hat wearer. Now, why is the health minister going around calling people who are sceptical about these vaccines tinfoil hat wearers? It does rather make you think that there is an agenda here and that anybody that's questioning what the government's doing is getting smeared, effectively, you know, a bucket of black paint and a brush being just thrown at them, rather than trying to learn and coming up with the best policy, listening to everybody and then deciding what to do. They've already decided that people who are sceptical about the vaccines have got to be just booted out of the way, and that's exactly what they've just now done to Dr. Anne McCloskey.
Well, they're investigating her. We will see what comes of that. Now, in most of life, Tony, you have to accept that the experts, you're not an expert,
well,
I'm
no,
not an expert.
Most of the time, I don't think we can during this. And also, I mean, we get these constant tally from the BBC. So many people have got COVID. Why don't we have a daily tally of the deaths, as she's saying there?
Yes.
At least 1,500 now,
yes,
from the vaccine every day on the BBC.
Even if it were the case that the vaccines killed people, if the vaccines killed less people than the virus, then it might still be justifiable to vaccinate people. And it actually then becomes an act of solidarity to be vaccinated, even if there's a risk, to protect others. And that's really ultimately
that's
what this
why,
is all about.
That's why some people have done it, I think, simply
Indeed.
Thinking that they're being public-spirited, but they've been potentially tricked there. Anyway, so let's have a listen. There's another thing going kind of tracking along here in the UK, which is the attempt to get a vaccine passport out there is really taking shape within the healthcare industry. And a lot of care workers are being told that unless they get double jabbed, that they'll have to leave their jobs in care homes. So one of those who runs care homes is called Nicola Richards. She runs something called Palm Row Health. And she was on the Woman's Hour this week, I think it was on Tuesday morning, speaking to Emma Barnett. And whenever I have Emma Barnett on, I always remind people that she is the daughter of the mafia, in the Jewish mafia in Manchester, that were running the brothels there for decades.
Manchester Jews who were mafia, not okay. Jewish mafia, Tony.
Okay, Manchester Jews who were mafia, who were running the brothels, and then suddenly she gets a nice job at the BBC, doing what effectively is anybody that comes along that might have a good case against what the lockdown policies are or the vaccine policies are. Emma Barnett is a little Alsatian dog that tries to bite bits off them. But anyway, so... Emma Barnett here talking to Nicola Richards from Palm Row Healthcare, who's very concerned about this whole idea of telling all her care workers they've got to get double jabbed.
There's a higher proportion of females in the industry. I think there are some concerns around fertility. And I think it's because as well, they've been compelled to have the vaccine. It's not across the healthcare sector as a whole. It's only applying to social care. And I think staff have felt let down by the government, that they put their own lives at risk during the early part of the pandemic with lack of testing, PPE, no vaccination. And now those very staff are facing, you know, losing their jobs on the back of it because they've been compelled to have it.
Is there not an irony there that there was demands and concerns about a lack of PPE, but when offered a jab, some are not taking it? You know, arguably, ultimately, the highest form of protection for both you and the person that you're looking after. And just to say, I must say this at this point, that it has been put out there that there isn't any evidence at the moment of links to fertility issues. So I need to say that, of course, as a public service broadcaster.
Yeah, absolutely. I think they just feel let down by government. I think the fact that the NHS are not being compelled to have the mandatory vaccine at the moment, I think that is a real issue. It feels like social care staff have been singled out again. You can't ignore that the sector was very fragile pre-COVID. Staff recruitment, retention has been an issue, and we're facing more challenges now than we were back at the beginning of the pandemic. So we can't ignore that social care has been let down sadly again. And as responsible providers, we are all encouraging our staff to have the vaccine, but they have got their own reasons and we have to respect those reasons. They've been fighting this for nearly 18 months. Staff are tired, they're exhausted, and they just feel let down. And again, I think it's the way it's been handled by government.
But they are in the work of caring for people, looking after people, saving lives. In terms of the vaccine, you would think that that these are the people that would want it.
Absolutely. And we have seen, you know, a huge number of staff have the vaccine, but we have to respect personal choices. We can't ignore that. And again, when we look at the healthcare sector as a whole, why is this not being applied to the healthcare sector as a whole? We are losing some staff to the NHS because they don't have to have the jab. We're losing staff because of the pay, the conditions of social care staff. The government need to treat the healthcare sector as a whole, and they're not doing that.
But sorry, would that then mean those individuals who don't want to get jabbed at the moment for a variety of reasons, as you say, and I recognise that's not the majority, that would mean they would go and get it if there was an extension of this across all? It wouldn't mean that if you had issues about the actual jab, would it?
Absolutely. And I think you cannot ignore that the NHS has been treated very differently to social care staff when we're all providing care for vulnerable people. So I think the exception of social care, again, is just telling our staff that we are, you know, we're second rate to the NHS again. And I think you can't ignore that these people have put their lives at risk fighting this pandemic early on last year. And we can't ignore that. And we seem to be now obviously saying that social care staff were the cause of spreading COVID. We've had all sorts of excuses. We cannot ignore that government have failed us.
That's Nicola Richards there from Palm Row Healthcare speaking to Emma Barnett earlier this week on Women's Hour. Martin, there was an interesting assertion there by Emma Barnett, who I find one of the most irritating and annoying people I've ever known on the BBC. And luckily she's been taken off doing current affairs and stuck into Women's Hour. She's there saying that I'm a public service broadcaster. No evidence of any fertility issues to do with vaccines. Well, that's simply not true, Emma, is it? Because we were hearing, I think it was it last week or 2 weeks ago, 8 times more miscarriages in one of the trimesters for people that have had the vaccine. Now, that sounds to me like a fertility issue. If you're going to have a much bigger chance of a miscarriage, then I'm afraid there is evidence of fertility issues. But What about this whole bit? I mean, surely what's going to happen, Martin, is all these people are just going to leave the care homes if they're being told either you lose your job or you get a jab.
Well, the thing is, if that's what they assert, the government or whoever, then that's what will happen, isn't it? I think the point she made was very well made, is that why are we being singled out here? If everybody's got to have it, why doesn't everybody have it? And if it's, why is it just us that's being made to fulfil this criteria?
Yeah.
Which is obviously logically, there's a lot to be said for that.
There's another issue here, of course, which is all to do with the whole, there's been this kind of crisis going on for decades, hasn't there, in social care?
Yes, and of course what's happened is that what's happened in the last 18 months has brought all of these things to an excruciating head, hasn't it?
Over the last 48 hours, Boris Johnson has been apparently facing a furious Tory backlash over his manifesto-busting plan, says the Daily Mail, to hike national insurance to pay for the social care reforms. MPs are warning it's a massive mistake and not the actions of a Conservative government. Well, of course, you're going to have to increase tax to do this. I would have thought it's obvious of some sort. Boris Johnson is expected to unveil his new social care reform plan next week. Cabinet ministers are at war, well, this is the Daily Mail after all, over how to fund the overhaul of the care sector. Sajid Javid is said to have pushed for a 2% hike to national insurance, but Rishi Sunak wants a 1.5% rise. Number 10 wants 1%. Any increase in national insurance would break key 2019 Tory manifesto pledges, and national insurance increase would hit an estimated 25 million working Brits.
Well, the Tories are only willing to discuss raising national insurance because, of course, wealthy people pay poorer people pay a much higher proportion of their income in national insurance than wealthy people. The obvious way to fund things in social care is wealth taxes and inheritance taxes.
Upping the top rate of income tax.
Yes.
Maybe?
So, in other words, they always discuss this in terms of leaving aside the questions of whether they're breaking manifesto commitments or whatever. That's another issue, but they always discuss it in terms of if we've got to pay for something, then the poor are going to have to pay for it, so we'll have to raise taxes on the poor, but we've said we wouldn't. And of course, ultimately, they're describing how much tax they're going to put on the poor. And of course, the other issue here is there is a magic money tree. You could just print the money to do this. And in fact, the Tories, over the last while, have come to the understanding that in actual fact, there is a magic money tree. And Boris Johnson, of course, wants to be Santa Claus all the time. And he suddenly realised there is a magic money tree. We could just do this and just print the money, which is what they've been doing in Japan since the 1980s. But of course they can't do that because they're Tories. And of course their ideology is that you can't do that. So there is actually a way out for them, but they can't take it.
Well, early this week, I spoke to a lady called Karen Dodd. She is running something called the Freedom Network. Now, this doesn't just include stuff about COVID, although it's mostly COVID. She is including all sorts of things in there to do with the way the world is today. And also, she's taking quite a strong look ahead at this whole idea of the Great Reset, really contesting it, saying, well, they are going to do their Great Reset. We need to do our own Great Reset. And rather than try and run this sort of from a top down, what she's done is she's set up a whole load of local groups that are all completely autonomous. They can do what they want pretty much, but the main purpose of what she's doing is just to try and bring people together, and so here she is talking about one of the main concerns. And she does a weekly newsletter, which I'm on her list now, which is fascinating, although there's one or two things on there. There was something about the moon landings a few weeks ago which I would take with a pinch of salt. It's got some fascinating bits and pieces in there too, so here's Karen Dodd explaining to me a bit about some of the things that she's been bringing up recently in her newsletter. For example, what is actually in these vaccines? Before we hear from her, Martin, this is commercially confidential, isn't it? The whole, if someone wants to say, well, I would like to have a look at what's going into my body before it goes in, they're told, sorry.
Well, what they should do, of course, is end the patents on all these vaccines should just be made available. And Big Pharma, of course, wouldn't make any money out of that, which is why they don't want to do it. And, of course, everybody would then know what was in them. And of course, people saying, well, we think that this and that and the other's in them. Actual fact, as you say, nobody knows what's in them because it's a private patent run by a private company, unlike in China, Russia, Cuba.
if you're putting anything into your body, you know, if you're eating food, quite often or a menu, you want to know what's in it before you're putting it in the body. And that's what really surprises me, because also what I'm doing now, I'm chatting to people, doing little videos of people that contact me. And I'm saying, well, you've got really good information here. Can we do a chat? And then I can put it on one of the channels that we've set up. And there was a chap yesterday called James Hunt, and he had been vaccinated, but he now realizes that he shouldn't have been vaccinated because he's done some research. He's a lovely chap, and we've got like a 20-30 minute, you know, talk about it and what made him think about it. And he didn't even realize that the vaccine was experimental, because he said, I'm just being a good citizen. I'm following the narrative. I'm doing what my government has told me. But then my son started sending me things, and I thought, oh, this is a bit odd. And he started to look. And then, so the information is there to find out what is in the vaccine and to know that it is experimental. Because a lot of people, they don't actually know it's experimental. And they have no idea what's in it. And it beggars belief, to be honest, that people do not think to actually look. They want an easy life. And that's what I find very frustrating.
People just do what they see everyone else around them doing. And also, I think there's a very devious, devilish side to all of this, which is, people are being tricked into thinking what they're doing is actually helping all those around them, where actually they could be putting an end to themselves potentially. And actually helping spread things even. Well, anyway, look, the next section are probably the most important, which is this whole move at the moment to vaccinate children, Karen.
I know, it's horrific. I mean, I'm very relieved that my children are no longer school age, and they're on my page, but obviously they're being taunted, aren't they? Because my daughter was just at a Reading festival where they had a vaccination tent there, and most of the people that she was with are vaccinated. So, you know, they're the young crew. There was one in Brighton. I think they popped up a, you know, the big vaccination tent or something at Brighton, the shopping mall. So they are encouraging the children as much as possible, the young people, and they know what they're doing again. It's absolutely sickening, because kids want to go out and party. They want to go to festivals. They want to travel. And that's the reason why they say, well, yeah, I'll have a vaccine because I want to go on holiday, or I want to do this, that and the other. Half of them can't anyway. And you know, when you go on holiday and you get on a plane, you go to the other side, God knows what's going on in the other countries. It's horrific. And again, looking at the newsletters, we've got this Gillick competence thing, which is unbelievable, that it's giving young people the right to make decisions about their own body. And they've got no idea, other than the fact that they want to go out and party. So, yeah, I mean,
there are some parents who are even considering, and I don't know if they've actually done it, keeping their children away from school to make sure that they don't get vaccinated, you know, behind their backs.
Yeah, that's right. They have done it. And also, again, through the network, it's great because I'm talking to these people. And, for instance, a lot of people that I know of are home educating their children now, which I would be doing if my children were at school. There's no way I'd be allowing them to go to school, because I just wouldn't trust it, partly because of this Gillick competence. And we had it before when my daughter, she's 19 now. So when she was at school, and they offer the young ladies, I think, 13 or 14, this vaccination to prevent them getting a cervical cancer. I can't remember what the jab's called now. And I was against it. And so you get the letter, and I wrote back. I said, no, thank you. We're not having that. So then they wrote to my daughter, and this is going back like 5 or 6 years. So this is a Gillick competence thing that we're talking about. They asked my daughter, they said, well, your mum said no, but if you want to, you can have it. And whatever your mum says, we're going to ignore. We're going to go with you. So she was 14 or 15. Luckily, she's got the common sense. And I told her about it. We're very open in the family, and she didn't have it. But there was only her and her one friend. Two of them out of the whole of the class, the rest of them had it. And this is, again, it's this Gillick competence. So if you're there, if you're in the environment, if you're in the school, that can be enough for people to, you know, just be jabbed. And you've got the peer pressure. So it's very difficult for one child or one young person to say, no, thank you, I don't want it, when all the friends are saying, oh, go on. It's hard being a teenager anyway. So they really know what they're doing, these people, our people, the creatures behind this. They've done a very, my hat goes off to the way they've done it. It's beyond evil.
But look, included in this, there's things about the moon landings. I mean, chemtrails. Are you sure it's a good idea to be including that sort of stuff with the information to help people cope with the medical tyranny we're going through at the moment?
Well, I think it's a good point because I'm kind of the messenger, to be honest, Tony. As I say, the groups, the people that come to me, some of them haven't had access to any of this information. They're just thinking, oh, it's about a jab, you know, and nothing more. But there is an ulterior motive behind this, which is a little bit sinister. And I think when you start looking, then you can find answers. And people might just be getting fed up with learning about COVID. They think, well, you know, what else is going on? So I'm just sowing seeds, which is what I do. I sow seeds. I go through the stuff that people send me and I share it, and some of the stuff I research myself. And I thought, well, that's interesting. I'd like to know more about that.
But isn't it a bit, you know, difficult because people can't question everything? It's almost like it's too much to take on all at once.
It is. Less is more. Some people say less is more. And actually, I can't remember when, but a few months ago, I said, right, there's enough information out there now. You've got your, you know, Telegram groups and WhatsApp groups and all these other groups that have set up so you can find your own information. And then people came back and said, no, can you please carry on with these newsletters? Because you send us information that we either don't have time to find out ourselves, because some of them are working, some of them, you know, are carers, some of them have got children. So they don't actually have the time. And some people said, we actually run our meetings because I encourage through the network, I send out this newsletter. But when somebody contacts me, I send them just a basic idea of how to set up a hub. And it's common sense, really. Obviously, if you're going to set up a group, you'll need one more than one person. So, you know, get a group together and then start discussing what do you want to do. And some of them might not have children, but they might be more interested in the moon landings or 9/11 or whatever else comes their way. So it's just me just sowing seeds so people can go and do what they want to do. I haven't spent a lot of time on this other thing, but when this video about the moon landings came, I saw a different version of it a long time ago, and then I thought it was white. So I thought, oh, I want this because I think people do need to see it because they will try and wipe it.
So that's Karen Dodd there talking about her Freedom Network. I'll put a link up to that. If you're interested in seeing if there are groups in your part of the country, they've got some in different parts of the world too, but it's mainly in the UK. She's making some good points there, Martin, particularly about this whole idea of vaccinating children, which is why I keep coming back to that. You know, you being at school, you're going to be there. I mean, what about this this whole thing of vaccinating the kids without parental consent?
Well, I don't think you're allowed to do that.
Well, that's exactly what they're now talking about. They're saying, well, if the children come to us at school, under 18s, and say they want to be vaccinated, we will vaccinate them.
As I understand it, at the moment, as you said earlier, the government is discussing whether children under 16, I think it is, are going to be vaccinated or not. So they may decide that they're going to do that, or they may not.
Well, yeah, but you haven't addressed my point about parental consent, have you?
No, but if you're under 16, you have to have parental consent. And I don't think that, you know, she was right about that. You've got to have parental consent for under 16s. But over 16s, it obviously is a different matter.
Okay, yeah, less is more, she said. And I think that sometimes I was told that by my publisher, who never actually published my book eventually. He said, actually, Tony, less is more. This is the stuff I sent him, which was the book of my articles and then also some extracts. And I said that was what I was going to do. But what I eventually did is I published them as two separate things completely. So it's just the articles in The Siege of Heaven and just the extracts in The Siege of Heaven Reader. So hopefully he will pick up that and he'll publish it that too. But yeah, so that's what I've tried to do. A bit of less is more. You don't want to shove everything at everybody at the same time. Try and find out what people are interested in and make sure that you've provided what they want. Then they can come back and get some more if they've enjoyed that first bit. But anyway, so that's Karen Dodd. We've got a bit more from her because I asked her at the end of the interview, and I put the full thing up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk later tonight, about where she thinks this is heading. And she started her answer by talking about a charity that she's been running over in Sierra Leone in order to get water to one of the poorest countries in the world.
I've got a charity called Friends of Chima and Kizzy, and we build schools and work with the women that conduct the FGM, the female genital mutilation. So we're teaching them to do other things. And there I was in Sierra Leone, one of the poorest countries in the world. And I got a phone call from my son, who's a ski instructor, and he was actually in Davos instructing one of these key players because it was during the World Economic Forum. And to me, it was just, I can't believe it. I was in the middle. There I was in the poorest country in the world and talking to somebody, my son, who was speaking to those that are the richest people in the world. And that was, again, a wake-up call for me because I thought, how out of sync, how out of balance this is. You've got we're all human at the moment. We're all human. So that's why I say we need a shake up. This 1% that have got far too much, way too much. How many yachts do you need? You know, how many houses do you need? There's so much money, you can't spend it in 100 lifetimes. So it's not just about the wealth, it's about power. And that's what needs to be sorted out. I think the people that are greedy and are sort of power and the psychopaths, we need to clear up. So and therefore, with the Freedom Network, these are autonomous groups. There's nobody at the top saying you're going to own nothing. If you want to own nothing, that's fine. But if you want to own a lot, that's fine as well. Do what you want to do. Autonomous groups that need to be set up. And I have these questionnaires I send out, and the people that do send them in, the answers are virtually all the same. They want community. You know, they want to be with their friends, their family. They want to get on and live their lives. They don't all want big houses and stuff like that. Maybe some of them can. That's fine as well. It's up to them. But basically, we want to come back into community and work together and work on the land with the land.
Okay. So do you think that the World Economic Forum has got some of the right solutions then?
No. No, I don't, because they've got ulterior motives. They're telling us all this nonsense that, you know, it's the same as this green agenda, you know, which is all part of that's the next plan, isn't it? They're going to stop us walking in fields. They're going to stop us swimming in the sea. We've seen a little bit with the lockdown where people have been surfing and they've been fined $1,000 because they've been surfing. I mean, what's that got to do with COVID? It's absolutely absurd. And what was it in New Zealand? I saw something the other day that they were saying, the health minister there, she was saying, don't order anything online because you're putting in jeopardy the driver of that package that's going to be delivered to you. I mean, it's absolutely absurd. They want us in our boxes. They want us in our cages watching nonsense TV and eating pizza delivered by, you know, not by taxis, by Uber. That's what they want. They don't want us out enjoying nature. And because of that, they are setting up this ridiculous agenda, you know, that we've got to save the planet. But that's obviously, I think, for another day, that conversation.
Yeah, so maybe we will have that conversation another day. That's with Karen Dodd, who set up the Freedom Network, which is a place where people can get in touch geographically with like-minded types in their area and discuss these things. And as she says there, meeting people face-to-face, that's one of the main things that this is all about. That's something that you're not allowed to do, Martin, during a lockdown, isn't it?
Yes, and in New Zealand for the last year, most people haven't been in lockdown. They've had everything functioning as normal, as it does in China. And it's us that's in lockdown because of the denial of COVID.
But we're not in lockdown, are we?
Not now, but we may
be
down.
Are you hoping we're going
back?
No,
I'm not. I'm hoping that the vaccine rollout works and we're at the end of lockdown.
And what about hoping that ivermectin works?
Well, I'm willing to listen to arguments about ivermectin. But that's not really the countries which have managed this in Southeast Asia have done very, very well. China hasn't been in a lockdown for over a year, and their economy has boomed during that period. And that's because they got it right in the first place. And then they can choose what vaccines they're going to use or not use any vaccines at all.
Maybe
the Chinese Communist Party needs to be knocking out ivermectin so they get all of their military completely ivermectined up.
And then
we go to war.
I would suggest that's exactly what has been going on, because the research quite clearly shows this stuff is extremely useful when it comes to the coronavirus. I mean, another thing that you could do, of course, is you were a chief medical officer of the Chinese military, you could say, well, I want every one of my soldiers to get the coronavirus common cold right now, please. Just stick it up their nose.
No, they didn't do that, though, did they? Because they knew it was a biological warfare attack.
No, the coronavirus common cold is not COVID-19.
Oh, I see.
It's a common cold. Well, and all it does is it makes you give a bit of a sniffle. But then when COVID comes along, you can...
Oh, so by having... I've had many colds in my life.
Yeah.
So that means I've got immunity to, you could, to coronavirus.
You could possibly, if you've had the coronavirus common cold, have immunity to COVID, yeah.
Wow, that's an amazing conclusion for you to draw.
No, it isn't. It's not at all amazing, because this
is... So everybody who's had a common cold has already got immunity to COVID.
That's not what I said, is it? That's not what I said, is it?
Oh, the coronavirus common cold.
There are about five different types of common colds. And we've had this from Stanley Laham. I don't know if you, you probably weren't listening. This is about a year ago, talking about what is a coronavirus. Well, a coronavirus actually is a common cold. And if you've had that coronavirus common cold within a few years of catching COVID, it means that you're very unlikely to get anything much more than a sniffle.
Now, I'm willing to enter into these debates.
So that's the sort of thing we could give to the Chinese military if you want them to be ready for war.
No, no.
Yes. That's the sort of thing.
Tony, we're getting...
That's a traditional vaccine, which is a denuded version of the nasty COVID-19.
That's exactly what the Sinopharm vaccine is in China. They've not... all this stuff about it... The Pfizer vaccine clearly is a new technology, which isn't a vaccine that is as traditionally understood. But that doesn't mean that the Sinopharm vaccine is like that, or that the Cuban vaccines are like that. They're not. They've been produced under, as traditional vaccines. I mean, we could argue all about the ins and outs of the science of this. And what you do every week is you've got scientists or people like Karen who have got their own
views.
Well,
these are generally censored people that you say, well, this is all just anecdotal. But they're not being heard. Why they're being heard on here.
I understand, Tony, but you've got to also understand that because I work in schools and so on, I don't always have the time to do the research and I'm not really that interested in coronavirus as such. The point is that the majority of people support the majority of the experts most of the time.
We're not that interested on what the majority think around here because the majority watch the censored news. I mean, for example, let's look just going over to the Global Times. This is an online article. I'm not sure if you sent me this or one of our correspondents sent it to me. Coronavirus modifications. Undisclosed virus incident. Details. Close contact with Fort Detrick. Six doubts surround US UNC labs. So what they're saying here, I'll just read you out the first paragraph. The COVID-19 pandemic prevention and control situation remains grim across the world as the virus continues rapidly mutating and the new variants spread much more readily. In brackets, Tony's square brackets, despite everyone being vaccinated. Many countries have witnessed COVID cases rebound. At this critical moment, the international community should unite together to fight the pandemic. However, the US government continues to engage in political manipulation and hype rumours, including the so-called Wuhan laboratory leak theory, casting a heavy cloud over possible international cooperation against the pandemic. I saw it again this week, a press conference by Republican politicians in the state saying some good things, but laying the blame firmly at the door of China, saying this is all a Chinese virus.
Well, the Chinese, I think, are aware that this is probably an attack on them, which may have come via the Wuhan laboratory. Don't forget, it was the Pentagon who funded the research in the Wuhan laboratory into back coronavirus.
So anyway,
and also the University of, I think it's the University of North Carolina, was the source of the original bat coronavirus gain of function
virus. Well, this is it. The lab at the University of North Carolina and Ralph Barrick, in charge of the lab at Chapel Hill, remains surrounded with questions and mysteries. Is these two entities that owe the world an explanation when it comes to the lab leak theory? So we're saying that even if it's a lab leak, it wasn't necessarily anything to do with Wuhan.
The Chinese obviously don't particularly want to talk about it was Wuhan, but I think what may be going on here is we're dealing with either an accidental leap from Fort Detrick, which is what Larry Romanoff was suggesting, which then what they do is they then weaponize that by making sure it gets into China. The Iranian Revolutionary Guard are saying that we think this is an attack on us, this bio warfare. Because we've got the strain which attacked most of our senior people wasn't even the same as the Wuhan virus strain.
Who is this guy Ralph Barrick then that this article is very much focusing on? It says he's an American scientist who is called the coronavirus hunter. God, we've got Batwoman and now this coronavirus hunter too. He's well known for his technique of reverse genetics in terms of the coronavirus used to mix and match parts of multiple viruses. Great. Nice one. This is the sort of guy that Barack Obama was trying to haul out of the laboratories and probably just burn them down because he realised, like many other sensible people with a bit of common sense, that this is an insane thing to be doing. Barrick pioneered the study of SARS, MERS and a novel coronavirus in the US, where he works has been modifying the genes of various coronaviruses and creating new strains to explore their possible contagiousness to humans.
Yeah, So in other words, I would argue, and you would no doubt agree with me, that you shouldn't be carrying out gain-of-function research into dangerous viruses. The reason they do carry out gain-of-function research into dangerous viruses is it's ultimately military research. Most of this research is being carried out in US laboratories in places like Georgia and in Southeast Asia. And the fact that the Pentagon were funding the Wuhan laboratory to carry out this research is because it's part of their program to try and find genetic weapons which, for example, would just kill Chinese people. They were doing similar things in South Africa.
They were doing similar things in Israel, I remember, too. Yes.
Yes. Now, in other words, in actual fact, the human genome is much too mixed up for that to actually work.
Thank God.
Yes, but at the same time, what it means is when you carry out a biological warfare attack on China, which they deal with through administrative methods, not through vaccines, it then blows back and everybody can catch it. And then you've got to decide what you're going to do.
Lockdown. That's what they want you to do anyway.
No, the lockdown.
Destroy all the civil liberties.
The lockdowns in the West, if the Chinese had not carried out their lockdown when they did, and they'd had a massive COVID wave, which would have wrecked their economy, that would have been the perfect result. And then everybody can be put into lockdowns and made to take vaccines. But if the Chinese at the very earliest stages, possibly because their intelligence services know what's going on, lock down straight away, get rid of the COVID threat, and then let it flow back over everybody else, that means that the chances of them winning World War III are severely limited. And what your side of this argument can't seem to accept is that lockdowns, if they're carried out effectively at the beginning of the process, are the way to deal with
Martin,
it.
Martin, what your side of this argument can't seem to accept, that lockdowns are totally unnecessary when you've got a disease which is going around, which is a 0.02% casualty rate.
Yeah.
Lockdowns are not necessary,
we should just let it flow through. There's no threat at all.
If it is a certain threshold of people dying of it, obviously a lockdown is needed.
But if it's a biological warfare agent, as we've discussed, it's not there to kill everybody. It's there to wreck the economy. And the way it wrecks the economy is by
lockdowns.
That's right. Unless you do the lockdown at the first stage, and then you don't have to lock down afterwards.
Or unless you treat it. So this is a quite complicated issue.
Well, the idea
that you can't treat it is just wrong. One of the aspects to this...
We'll see about this. We
won't see about this. It's quite clear from all these studies, including Tess down here in Bath, Dr. Tess Laurie, that you've got an incredible... Well, I think it was something like 80%, 90% of people who are treated with ivermectin who would go to hospital don't go to hospital because they've been treated with ivermectin. Anyway, the bigger picture, obviously, and I think for me, much more interesting in many ways, is this whole idea of this being a eugenics program. The idea that this is a way of just either culling the population, getting rid of people. And I know, you know, I don't know what you make of Fort Russ News, but they have had an interesting piece over the last few weeks by Matthew Eret. And this actually is, I think, it was earlier this year anyway. Cain's sleight of hand, from Fabian eugenicist to world government high priest. It's a whole look at John Maynard Keynes as a eugenicist. So it's saying that to start the article, it says it's as if the battle lines of the Civil War have been drawn up between masses of Americans who've been led to believe in either a false bottom-up approach to economics, as defined by the Austrian school, represented by Friedrich von Hayek, or in the top-down approach of John Maynard Keynes. The former sacrifices the general welfare of the whole nation for the sake of the parts, i.e. individual liberties, while the latter sacrifices the individual liberties of each citizen for the sake of the general welfare. So he's going on really to talk about Keynes as a eugenicist. Was he, do you think?
Well, Keynes was influenced by the kind of things that were floating around in the milieu from which he came, which was he was a scholarship boy to Eton. He was very much part of the elite. And he said, you know, if it came to the revolution, I'd be very much on the side of the bourgeoisie. So he was very much not a revolutionary. His theories were about how to make capitalism work better. And that was also a spin involved in that, because his main way of trying to get people to do things was to explain to his chums in the elite look, we can do better than this if we just have a better way
just,
of doing it.
Let me just carry on a bit in the article. This is seen clearly in his, number one, his devotion to the theories of Thomas Malthus. Number two, his promotion of eugenics as a science of racial purification and population control. And three, his general devotion to world government as a leading member of the Fabian Society.
So he says, was never in the Fabian Society.
Well, that's apparently he was. Well,
no, he wasn't. Say, he was never. The Fabian Society is actually linked to the Labour Party, and Keynes was actually a liberal, so he was never in the Fabian Society.
Well, that's an interesting...
The Fabian Society were much more influenced by things like the Soviet Union.
Point.
Well, from I read his articles, from his earliest, I felt that immediately. He's just wrong.
From his earliest,
he was never a Fabian.
From his earliest days at Cambridge, where he rose quickly to become one of the select Cambridge Apostles. Is that wrong, too?
No, he's a member of the Apostles. He was a founder member of the Apostles, but that's not the Fabian Society.
And shared, amongst things, a lifelong friendship with Lord Bertrand Russell. Keynes devoted himself to the service of empire, becoming a Knight of the Order of the Bath and the Order of Leopold by 1919. So, yeah, interesting character. And I wasn't aware of that he was a eugenicist. What is the problem with eugenics? Is there a problem with it?
Well, if you think about it, in that era, before Adolf Hitler, virtually all intelligent people, left-wing or right-wing, were eugenicists, and they believed that, in actual fact, we've got to try and improve the human race by getting rid of the... either educating the lower orders...
It's like weeding, isn't it? Yes, in the garden. Yes, you know, so anybody that's disabled
before,
or something...
Before Hitler's, bloody barbarism, eugenics was actually quite... normal amongst middle class people, all, and you can still find it when you talk to middle class people today who moan about the poor family down the road with five kids, but they still haven't got a job and they're all drinking too much.
Yeah.
The gypsies and all the rest of it. Yes, and of course it's just a continuation of that. And even the sort of more liberal end of that is we're going to get rid of all of these poor. You know, we're going to make them richer and better off, and we'll stop them having too many children and all the rest of it. So. And in any case, there is also a wider question, which is, how many people do we actually want at the end of the day? And that's an issue whether you're a eugenicist or not.
Do you think the world is overpopulated?
The world is overpopulated with rich people. And the obvious thing to do if we wanted people to survive is kill the rich. They're the ones that need to go, aren't they?
The rotating knives on the Monty Python housing estate.
Well, no. Well, what you're dealing with is the human wave attacks at the Battle of the Imjin River, where the glorious Gloucesters were nearly overwhelmed by the Red Army.
These people are busy digging bunkers right now, Martin. A lot of building work going on.
Yes, in New Zealand in particular.
And anyway, so we'll finish up part one. With a look at some of the actual technical stuff behind this eugenics, which is going on right now in Australia. It's to do with the QR code.
QR. It stands for quick response, and we've responded very quickly. A big part of living with COVID about to become bigger, the check-in, soon to also check up on vaccination status.
If you are vaccinated, then you can be exempted from various restrictions that may still more broadly remain in place.
The plan is to link Medicare vaccination status to QR check-in profiles using a traffic light system, flashing green at check-in for vaccinated, amber for medically exempt, and red for unvaccinated.
People will be able to do everything at the one go. They'll be able to QR code, they'll be able to demonstrate they've been vaccinated.
Whether a shop, restaurant, or bar denies service will be up to them. The vaccination data will also help contact tracers if the business becomes an exposure site.
It's also important in the future that people who are unvaccinated going into particular places, that we know that they've been there.
All this for when vaccination rates hit the 70 and 80% targets, perhaps late October or November. Scott Morrison reminding the premiers that the plan then is that lockdowns are no longer locked in.
Premiers and chief ministers have signed up to that plan. But they haven't signed up with me, they've signed up with the Australian people.
Some premiers saying they did that before the current outbreaks.
The Doherty modelling is based on very low case numbers, not 10,000 active cases in New South Wales, not 300 active cases here in Victoria. Clearly that's no longer the case.
The Treasurer warning if premiers do lock down after the vaccination targets are hit, they'll have to pick up the bill.
They shouldn't have any expectation that there will be Commonwealth Emergency Economic Assistance like we're rolling out the door at that point in time.
Warning the taxpayer tap will be turned off. Mark Riley, 7 News.
So that's the US news about QR codes being prepaired over there. The irony here...
Australian, surely.
What did I say?
You said US.
Sorry, yes, that's from Australia, yeah. So the QR codes being introduced in Australia. The irony here, of course, being that, we'll be talking about maybe 18 months ago, we were hearing all this stuff from China. They were saying, isn't this terrible? What they're doing is they're having some sort of, two-class system where if you've had a vaccine that you can have all be freedoms back, but if you haven't, that you're going to be basically stopped from travelling, stopped from leaving your home, all this sort of thing. So rather than all the scaremongering that has been over the last 20 years about, you know, China in Australia and New Zealand, now it seems that the government itself is implementing these Chinese-style schemes to lock down the population, or maybe be better to say lock up the population who haven't been vaccinated, Martin.
Well, I mean, the question of vaccine passports is a question, but in China, of course, their social credit system is a system that's been in place for a long time anyway, and it's nothing to do with vaccines. So, you know, the issue
I wasn't actually talking about social credit specifically, although, of course, that is in the background to this. We were hearing from the BBC in China about 18 months ago, one of the first things they were doing was having these, I guess it's to do with the track and trace system, but it's if you've been got a positive test recently, you get a little thing on your phone which allows you to move around. If you haven't, then you just have to sit in at home. You're not allowed out at all.
Yes, and that's all to do with the administrative methods they've been using to deal with the pandemic. And no doubt they'll have to if they're going to vaccinate their population, and it looks like they are, then they're going to have to bring in similar stuff. But I mean, that goes with the territory as far as the Chinese are concerned.
Well, it does. If it comes to totalitarian control and tyranny, if you're just going to split your population into two and say you can have freedom and you can't.
Yeah, or you can live in places like Bolivia and India, where 40% of the population just die without any healthcare every day. It's just going on all the time.
Or you can live in Britain, where at the moment there is no vaccine passport or QR codes to go anywhere.
Indeed.
Thank God. Anyway, we'll be back talking Afghanistan with former UN weapons inspector and US Marine Corps Intelligence Colonel Scott Ritter after a 15-minute musical break.
Yeah. devils gathered in their masses, just like witches at black masses. Evil minds that plot destruction, sorcerer of death's construction. In the fields of bodies burning, as the war machine keeps turning. Death and hatred to mankind, poisoning their brainwashed minds. Oh, Lord, yeah. Stops turning, ashes where the body's burning. No more war pigs have the power, and Asgard has struck the hour. Day of judgment, God is calling, on the knees the war pigs crawling. Begging mercies for the sins, Satan laughing spreads his wings. Oh, Lord, yeah.
Josephine, what do all these policemen mean by coming to the convent in a grim limousine after Sister Josephine? While you, Sister Josephine, you sit with your boots up on the altar screen, you smoke one last cigar. What a funny nun you are. The policemen say that Josephine's a burglar in disguise, big bad Norman, 15 years on the run. The sisters disbelieve it, no, that can't be Josephine. Just think about her tenderness towards the younger nuns. Oh, Sister Josephine, they're searching the chapel where you've been seen, the nooks and the crannies of the nuns' canteen, after Sister Josephine. While you, Sister Josephine, you sip one farewell Benedictine before your au revoir. A right funny nun you are. Admittedly, her hands are big and hairy and embellished with a curious tattoo. Admittedly, her voice is on the deep side, and she seems to shave more often than the other sisters do. Oh, Sister Josephine, founder of the convent pontoon team, they're looking through your bundles of rare magazines after Sister Josephine. While you, Sister Josephine, you give a goodbye sniff of Benzedrine to the convent budgerigar. A bloody funny nun you are. No longer will her snores ring through the chapel during prayers, nor her lustful moanings fill the stilly night. No more empty bottles of altar wine come clunking from her cell. No longer will the cloister toilet seat stand upright. Oh, Sister Josephine, slipping through their fingers like Vaseline, leaving them to clutch your empty crinoline after Sister Josephine. While you, Sister Josephine, sprinting through the suburbs when last seen, dressed only in your wimple and your rosary, a right funny nun you seem to be.
Jake Thackeray there from 1967 with Sister Josephine. Before that, the classic War Pigs from Black Sabbath, 1970. I'm not sure of the year of it, but we started off with Mozart's Requiem, the Lacrimosa. Martin, let's just get cracking with the horrific events in Afghanistan over the last week, particularly this bomb attack. Now, we're not quite sure whether it was just a supposed... I mean, what we were told was that the United States detected a suicide bomber in a vehicle heading for the airport and decided to destroy the vehicle. What I heard from the BBC on the ground was that there was no secondary device, no secondary explosion. So it doesn't look as if there was actually a bomb in this vehicle. The only thing was the attack from this US drone. So what have you been able to put together about what happened earlier this week?
Well, there's a number of different things happened. There was an attack at Kabul airport, and then there's two drone strikes that have been carried out subsequently. So I was talking to RT earlier this week on Monday about the bomb attack at Kabul airport and the aftermath, which according to eyewitnesses interviewed by RT who were on the programme I was on, was a massacre carried out by US troops of the crowd which had, you know, which were caught up in the bomb attack, presumably, or nobody really knows, out of panic. And they also interviewed a doctor in a hospital who was treating the wounded, as saying, well, lots of them have got no shrapnel wounds, they've just got bullet wounds. So, you know, the evidence seems to suggest that the bomb attack took place. and then the troops opened fire on the crowds that were there, and don't forget there's nearly 170 dead, and one interview with somebody who was on the ground.
So let's make it clear, there's two separate bombs, one at the airport itself, and then another one, some supposed suicide bomber heading for the airport.
Yeah, but the second one, it turns out, I mean, they've admitted this now, that it was actually a family with lots of young children, and there was no bomb. If there had been a bomb in the vehicle, it would have been a different kind of explosion. And these, in fact, were people...
Well, that's it. That's what I said about the BBC correspondent saying there was no... Made it absolutely clear on the news, on the bulletin on Tuesday morning, no secondary explosion.
Yes, and also BBC journalist about the first bomb, he tweeted that there was evident, you know, that it looks like the Americans have killed the most people here. The bomb went off and killed 13 of their people. And then there's nearly 170 dead. And... he said it looks like the military here have killed quite a lot of people after the bomb attack. The BBC didn't report that, but he was a reporter on the ground and he put it on his Twitter feed. Okay, and there was the further report by a local Kabul-based TV station where they were talking to somebody who said, well, most of the people that were killed by the US military.
I mean, is it really possible that an attack by the American military shooting into a crowd of civilians and killing maybe 100 or more people, that can be just reported as, oh, well, this was a suicide bomber, you know, we had to send a drone in?
Well, there was no drone on the day of the first bomb attack, okay? I think there's a bigger question of who was the suicide bomber and how did they get there? Because the Taliban apparently had told the Americans there's a danger of somebody coming in with a suicide bomb here. Did you see Dominic Raab back here? He came under fire because there was a suggestion that that particular gate had been kept open because the British were pushing for the gate to be kept open, but the Americans wanted to close the gate. Now, this is kind of finger-pointing going on between the British and the Americans.
But at the end of the day, it's 10 family members were killed in this second attack, and 7 children. I mean, this doesn't, and no secondary explosion, this does suggest that this is just a massacre of innocent people by the Americans.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously, we could go, perhaps we will go into the detail of who ISIS-K are and what may be going on the geopolitical front.
Do please, and compare them to and contrast them with the Taliban.
Yeah,
please.
Well, okay, but before we do that, I'll just reiterate what I said on RT, which is that if what's, you know, the ostensible information we're getting here is true, then when a bomb goes off like that, your troops are not supposed to open fire on a crowd. That is really bad. You know, it just shows that you've gotten... Presumably they were frightened that there was another suicide bomber in the crowd. Yeah? Now, you're not supposed to do that. The other thing is, they then get into a state of... You know, if you look at the US media, they're going on that 13 of our young people are dead. That's the thing they're concerned about. It's the only thing they're bothered about. And that's why Biden then said, but we're going to get them back. And then they press a button and send 2 drones into Afghanistan to kill 7 children and 3 adults from the same family, which, of course, doesn't do anything to solve any problems at all. Total waste of time. And of course, they've been doing this for years. This isn't just a one-off.
Partly the reason why the United States has completely failed to win over hearts and minds, because they're killing all these innocent people.
Well, that's right. That's exactly what. And of course, in Australia, it's come out that the Australian SAS, you know, Australia's quite a right wing country and it's got a right wing government, but through investigations, it's come out that their Australian SAS have been involved in extrajudicial murders and torture of loads and loads of people. Now, if there's any international law, they should all go on trial, shouldn't they, and be sent to prison forever. But that's not going to happen. But at the same time, of course, we have been under, you know, the way the media have presented this in the West, the terrible Taliban coming back to power, the government in Afghanistan that they've overthrown had no popular support, ran death squads, and the military supporting them, our military, uses overwhelming firepower and air power. And they, I mean, Hamid Karzai, who used to be the head of the puppet regime, if we can call it that, he broke with the Americans some time ago. And when they dropped the mother of all bombs, if you remember that, in 2018, the biggest bomb ever dropped that wasn't a nuclear bomb, he just said, this is disgusting, you know, what are you doing? And of course, if you think about it, if you're fighting an insurgency, dropping a bomb which is a similar explosive power to a nuclear weapon, what's the point of that? It's just going to kill loads of people and make the insurgents... I mean, the Taliban have basically won by persuading the people they're fighting that they're a better option. And of course, people in this country probably won't accept, although they're going to have to accept it, that our forces have been involved in killing thousands and thousands of civilians in Afghanistan. Up to a quarter of a million civilians have died since we invaded the country. And many of them have been killed by our troops and our RAF and all the rest of it. Now, is that a war crime? I don't know. People making their own mind.
Well, I mean, you know, the other thing is, of course, that they're perfectly within their rights to be fighting back against that.
Well, that's right. There was no UN resolution to go into Afghanistan.
No, there was. Yes, there was.
No, there wasn't.
It was all legal.
No,
yeah.
No. Well, in actual fact, the Chinese and the Russians abstained. So there wasn't a UN resolution. It was NATO that went in.
Well, hang on. No, I think it was all done. All the dots were ticked legally on Afghanistan after the it was immediately after the 9/11 attacks. The UN said, yes, go for it. Go and find bin Laden. Use whatever means you need to do.
We'd have to check that, but I'm not quite sure whether that's the case.
Anyway, so what do you think about this guy, Zalmay Khalilzad? I've came across him, and I'll put this up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Some guy we've not heard about hardly at all on any of the news over here, but he is the deal breaker. It's a shame that we haven't had him all over the TV getting grilled about this mess that's been created, because he is the CIA Afghan guy who's cut this deal with the Taliban.
Well, he's been involved in what the US does in Afghanistan for years, because he's got an Afghan background, a bit like Ghazi. I was reading an article about earlier. He's basically, I mean, Ghazi spent most of his life living in the United States, wealthy Afghan, and he was basically imposed by the United States as their puppet. Karzai, on the other hand, was their puppet, but he's remained behind in Afghanistan to negotiate with the Taliban because he's made himself independent of his US backers. And because he's a Pashtun, he's basically said, you know, we've got to talk to the Taliban, and, you know, we can't, you've got, you know, the Americans here. And he also said in 2018, ISIS-K is a US front organization. This is the guy that used to be the president of Afghanistan. Now, Zalmay Khalilzad is a behind-the-scenes fixer, yeah? So Ghazni, who's just fled with the millions of dollars, he's essentially just, you know, he's a political puppet. He used to work for the World Bank, and he was very the West basically imposed him on Afghanistan. It wasn't clear that he won the last election. Abdullah looks as if he got more votes, but they weren't having that, you know. No, but of course, most of the population in the West hasn't been following this closely. They've just been presuming...
Well, no, of course they haven't. I mean, of course, it's the other side of the world. We just have to take what's read,
yeah,
what we're told by these various correspondents. And when all this stuff was happening at the beginning of the week, these various bombs going off at Kabul airport and massacres of civilians by US drones, we were getting, I think, isn't it, Barbara Plett-Usher and Lise Doucette, both of whom aren't British. They're not actually BBC. I don't know if both of their accents sound US accents. It's almost as if we're just getting US
were they on,
commentary.
I don't think they were even on the ground, though, were they?
Well, I think one of them was. I think maybe Lise Doucette was. But Barbara, or one of them, anyhow. But, you know, we're not even getting a British person giving us commentary. We're getting Americans, it seems. Let me just read the final bit of this guy, this article by William Engdahl, then, about Khalilzad. He says, the fall of Afghanistan was not the result of an intelligence failure by the CIA or the military, miscalculation by Secretary Austin and the Pentagon. Both knew, as did Khalilzad, what they were doing. When Austin approved the secret dark of night abandonment of the Bagram Air Base, largest US military base in Afghanistan, on the 4th of July, without notifying the Kabul government, it made clear to the US-trained Afghan army the US would give them no more air cover. The US even stopped paying them months ago, collapsing the morale further. This was no accident. It was all deliberate, and Zame Khalilzad was central to it all. In the 1980s, his role helped create the 1996 Taliban takeover. In 2001, the Taliban destruction. And now, in 2021, the Taliban restoration. The real gainer in this insanity is the globalist agenda, he says, of so-called Davos Great Reset cabal, who are using it to destroy the global influence of the US, as Biden domestically destroys the economy from within. No nation, not Taiwan, not Japan, not the Philippines, India, or even Australia, or even a nation hoping for US protection in the future, will be able to trust Washington to hold to its promises. The fall of Kabul is the end of the American century. Little wonder that Chinese media is filled with schadenfreude and jubilation as they discuss the Silk Road deals with the Taliban.
Yeah, but I mean, I read Engdahl's stuff, but I mean, there's an inherent contradiction in what he's just said there. He's saying that the US is being deliberately destroyed from within, but the Chinese are happy with what's going on.
Well, this would align with a lot of what I've said, is that through figures like Kissinger, that the tensions around the world are being ramped up, with the US being controlled by essentially the same people as China, trying to ramp both those big superpowers up to a third world war.
Well, this is where I part company.
Fine, yeah.
Because in actual fact, why the removal of the US from Bagram Air Base is suspicious. Because, you know, they could have used that airbase to evacuate people, for example. And they didn't have to just go and not tell the Afghan government what they were doing.
It does suggest that the whole thing, from the Mujahideen, from the Russians invading the Mujahideen in the 1980s, right the way through, has been orchestrated. Even possibly that the Taliban is at just one, I mean, from an overt US presence and British presence and NATO presence of Western soldiers there, now it's a covert presence that they are actually, you know, steering the Taliban, much as they've steered groups like ISIS and Al-Qaeda.
Well, the fact is that we have intervened in Afghanistan since the 1970s, and all we have left is misery and death. And that's what
we've done. But that doesn't help us understand what's going on, statements like that. I mean, the Saudis funding it most definitely is helping fund the Taliban.
And the Saudis have now kind of got a much more... they were at one stage very much funding them, but that's not necessarily the case now.
So what about the ISI? I mean, they have got a big influence with them. This is the Pakistani intelligence
service.
Yes,
that's true. And they've got much more influence over the Taliban than the Saudis.
The poor old Afghan people, ordinary people, they just seem to be, you know, they're in the wrong place on the chessboard.
They are. But you've got to remember that, for example, for Pakistan, they've got many Pashtuns in Pakistan, and the border between Pakistan, India, and Afghanistan was just simply a line drawn on the ground by General Durand in the 19th century, which actually split the Pashtun homeland in two. So there's, you know, these people are, in a sense, involved, and don't forget, they're neighbours of Afghanistan, so they've got much more interest in it than people in Saudi Arabia or in Britain.
Well, not the United States, which is about as far away as you can get.
Well, as you said in the early part of the show, this is why they're there, because it's a way of messing up. They need to control what they call the heartland after McKinley's
well, it's the world,
heartland
it's
theory.
It's the world island, it's Eurasia. The fact that the US has had to pull out of there, does that mean the US has given up its attempts to dominate the planet?
No. It just means that they've cut their losses when they were in a losing position. Don't forget that Trump had already negotiated withdrawal on the 1st of May. That was already agreed. And as far as the Taliban were concerned, that meant you're going on the 1st of May. Now, what Biden did is he then said, well, we're actually going to go on the 7th, September the 11th. Again, just politicking in terms of the US. But then they decided that they were going to, you know, if they're going to be out by the September the 11th, then they're going to have to go quicker than that.
Well, this is a very significant date, isn't it? I mean, yeah. We're 20 years since those 9/11 attacks. We'll be looking at them in more in depth and pulling up some of the stuff that's come out since 9/11 next week, no doubt. But this, I mean, just you know, I sometimes I try and think like a Nazi, think how these people think. They now need some new kind of 9/11, don't they? The whole 9/11 game has now come to an end. The move into Afghanistan, etc. They've pulled out, although of course they're still doing airstrikes and that sort of thing. They have some sort of influence or control over the Taliban. But they're not there physically anymore. So I would suggest we're now looking at quite a dangerous month in September, where it may be that something happens to take this agenda on to the next level, the post 9/11 one.
Yes, well, okay, let's come back to ISIS-K. They, according to Hamid Karzai, used to be the president of Afghanistan, are a front organisation for the Western intelligence services.
The Pentagon, NATO intelligence?
Yes, and the British, of course. They're all involved in
MI6, Rory Stewart.
Yes. Of course, in public, they're our greatest enemies, and that's why we had to go into Syria to fight ISIS, even though in actual fact we did virtually nothing to prevent ISIS functioning, and it was the Russian Air Force that had to bomb their royal convoys.
As Diliana Gatashifa showed, the United States was getting weapons through to ISIS deliberately, and actually even signing end-use certificates for those weapons, so that they could get through customs and stuff.
The Iranian military, the Russian Foreign Office and the Chinese have all been saying, we've got evidence that you've been moving militants around. So in the Raqqa pocket in Syria, US military helicopters took people from Raqqa to Afghanistan as they closed in on it. Yeah. So the Iranians, the Russians and the Chinese, they're our enemies. We don't take any notice what they say. But, I mean, Lavrov is quite a senior, you know, a credible figure. And he's been saying, look, we've been asking you questions about this for quite a while. Why are your military helicopters seemingly landing in ISIS territory and then taking people out and moving them around the world? And, of course, the answer is because they're being used as a front organisation.
Well, exactly.
Which could mean, in fact, that this bomb attack at Kabul airport, which killed 13 US service personnel, is actually a CIA bomb. If you follow my logic here.
Yeah, I certainly do, yeah.
Because, of course, it means that Biden is and also the withdrawal from Bagram. Biden isn't making the decisions. So Bagram is withdrawn. It creates a situation where we can demonise. You see, what they can do now is the Taliban can take over, but the economy's in ruins. And they need outside support in order to rebuild the country. So what they can do is just carry on wrecking it from outside. And that means nobody can do anything in Central Asia. Yeah. Now, the answer to that...
Well, they maybe have two front organisations fighting each other in order to keep the Chinese out.
Well, in actual fact, you've got the Northern Alliance remnants, you know, in the Panjshir Valley, who are the directly sponsored by NATO. And then you've got ISIS, which is indirectly sponsored by NATO. And between them, they can prevent a broad-based Taliban regime, which might include somebody like Karzai, who used to be the president of Afghanistan, from establishing a stable state and beginning to rebuild the country.
Before we lose it, what about this question of what next? Can you see anything on the horizon, a kind of new war on terror goes up a level, or, you know, for example, where these troops might be going that have now come home, they be off somewhere else? Where do you think this is heading in the next couple of months?
Well, let's just break it into two bits. The first bit is what might happen in Afghanistan. Now, it's possible that because of the way things have played out, that the Taliban have now been speaking to the Iranians, to the Russians, the Tajiks, the Uzbeks, and the Chinese, and the Pakistanis, is that Afghanistan could be stabilised. It may be that they can stabilise it because, if you know, they're on a bit of a roll. They know that they're, you know, that ISIS are a problem. And they know that the others be, but they can probably deal with it, and that might be good because then the Chinese and the Russians, if the West won't give them any money, the Chinese can say, "Don't worry, we've got loads of money. We'll sort you out." Now that, of course, will cause absolute fury inside the Beltway in Washington. So what they will want to do is sabotage that. So we can possibly expect to see more ISIS-style attacks inside Afghanistan to destabilise the new regime.
That makes sense to me. Yeah, I'm afraid so.
But they may find that dealing with the Taliban and the Pakistani army and the Russian army and the Chinese army, they're going to find it quite
tricky. Look, what about the wider geopolitics? Because we've got these various conflicts brewing away. We've got the Donbass. We've got the sort of conflict in eastern Ukraine between Russia and Ukraine. The attempt to take over Belarus. We've also got the South China Sea, which seems to be, we've got British warships there now. We've also, of course, got the Iran-Israel Middle East conflict and North Korea too. Well, so which of those four?
Well, the most likely one to kick off is the Israeli-Iran
conflict. I would
agree
with you, yeah, I think so.
Don't forget that the Israelis are basically pretty belligerent. The idea that they're...
We've also got a whole new ball game over there with Netanyahu out and Benny Gantz and Naftali Bennett in. And these guys have made it absolutely clear. We are prepared to start a war with the Iranians. I don't know if they've said they'll start it.
No,
they actually
said
they want it.
They've said they'll start it in order to put pressure on the other Western powers like America.
Of course, Dominic Raab and Blinken have been saying that's a terrible thing. Whatever you do, don't do that. No, they've been totally silent on it.
No, they haven't been saying that. They've been saying don't do that sotto voce because obviously they don't really want to deal with the consequences. But I think the Iranians have got sufficient deterrence to it. There's an element of people like Naftali Bennett who are rousing his own right-wing troops to get rid of Netanyahu and so on. But in practical terms, if they were to attack Iran, middle-class people in Israel would pay a massive price. The Iranians have sufficient deterrence.
Yeah, but people said back in 1939 Hitler will never invade Poland.
That's the problem, is that the people underlying all of this, particularly the right wing in Israel, who do not actually have a rational policy, they really believe that, God gave this land to them and they're entitled to it, and discussions about what other people want doesn't come into it. So they're not really on the same rush. You could say, well, that would be crazy. You could end up with a discussion.
There's definitely this kind of maniacal side to the Israeli rulers at the moment, which is almost like, well, if we create a massive war down here and all sorts of potential problems threatening the integrity of the Israeli state, the Americans will be straight over to help us.
Yes, I mean, that's the calculation. And they're potentially not wrong. I mean, what would happen if they attacked the Iranians is that the Iranians would hit back very, very hard. Hezbollah would hit back from Lebanon, for example. And the Iranians have got missiles which can hit anything in Israel. The Israelis haven't got anything like that. They're not really... You see, what asymmetry is now developing between the Western powers like Israel, who depend upon conventional air power, and the revisionist powers, Iran, China, Russia, who are relying upon missiles, which is not the same thing.
Well, these Russian missiles, they will knock spots off just about everything else, I think.
Well, that's right. That's the point. That's the point, because the missile they know that they can't compete. Although the Russians are, in fact, able to compete for air superiority. So that, the Americans haven't fought anybody who's got any chance of overwhelming their air superiority.
No, that's right, Libya and things like that, yeah.
But once they come up against people who can end their air superiority, then they're in trouble. And of course, not only do the Russians have potential to create air superiority and area denial and all the rest of it, their missiles can be fired from Siberia, and within half an hour they can hit anything on the planet within a sort of 1 meter radius. And that means that your surface ships are all potentially sinkable straight away.
Before we hear from a sensible attitude and analysis from Scott Ritter, we're going to hear from Joe Biden. But before we hear from Biden on Afghanistan, just a quick tangent, which is this attack this morning, or last, I suppose it's yesterday in New Zealand, Martin. A lone nutter, apparently, has been shot dead in Auckland, in the capital. Although they were known to be dangerous, the guy was being shadowed by the New Zealand Secret Services. What happened there? He didn't actually kill anybody.
He stabbed various people. This is breaking news, really. As I understand it, he's been known to the authorities for quite a while for basically just downloading stuff and tweeting sort of aggressive attitudes. And he was being followed on a 24/7 basis. So, you know, once he...
So they said is that they didn't have anything to actually put him in jail. Now, it does sound to me like the guy was clearly, you know... And also, of course, there's this question of, is this a terrorist or is this just a nutter?
Well, I think...
Who's roaming the streets?
I think for us, with our, you know, overall analysis, you've got to be, have an open mind. One of the things that this war on terror has done is it has radicalized lots of mentally unstable individuals on the right and on the left and in the Islamist community. And they then create a kind of, flotsam and jetsam, the sort of human chaff, which can then be worked into major terrorist attacks as patsies. Yeah. But this isn't a major terrorist attack. He's just walked into the shop, grabbed hold of a knife and tried to stab people. Now, that could be just a random
nutter. This guy is not, obviously, I mean, I would say, go so far as to say he's not a terrorist. If he's a terrorist, he's not just going to go in, find the first knife he finds and then start trying to stab people and not kill anybody. He's being talked about by Jacinda as an ISIS extremist, blah, blah. Well, maybe he's been looking at ISIS websites, but a real terrorist, Carlos the Jackal, would laugh at this guy.
Yes, I know, but it's a question of what we mean by the word terrorism.
Yeah.
And, of course, in modern parlance, it just means, say, the police use it here, if somebody is regarded as a terrorist attack, if they've got some kind of political motive. Yeah? So that includes loners.
So any kind of lunatic,
well,
who's looked at an ISIS website is a terrorist now.
Well, if he does something on the back of it, then it's classified as. But of course, that terrorism is not like the terrorism of the Provisional IRA nearly killing the Tory War Cabinet in 1991. But that's just a question of how effective they are. Yeah. Now, what we
suspect,
as you know,
Tony... Well, I mean, he's not like this guy,
Tony,
Brenton Tarrant from the Christchurch Mosque Massacre, yeah, a couple of years ago. Completely different kettle of fish. This, yeah, guy was obviously equipped to,
yes,
kill people.
Yes.
And quite a serious guy. And the other thing, by the way, is he certainly wasn't acting alone.
This is the point. This guy looks as if he's acting alone. Whereas Brenton Tarrant, there's got to be a question mark because it's too effective for a lone...
Well, also, if you have a look at the banned film, which is a criminal offence to possess in New Zealand, if you have a look at that banned Facebook Live film, you can see these guys dressed in red actually directing him, saying, you know, moving their arm up, turning and moving, at which point his car pulls out and pulls into the mosque. So that's why Jacinda and her security service friends in New Zealand don't want you to see that film. It's because it shows evidence that it wasn't just him who was conducting this operation.
Yes, and it's quite likely that it was, in fact, the New Zealand intelligence services working with the British and the Americans. That's most likely.
Also, apparently, John Podesta was over there the day before in New Zealand and flew out the day before. So anyway, let's get back to Afghanistan, because we're going to hear now. It'd be great to hear what you've got to say about this, Martin, because this is Joe Biden explaining what's been going on, why it's been time to end the war in Afghanistan. And here he is speaking. I think this was Wednesday evening this week.
This decision about Afghanistan is not just about Afghanistan. It's about ending an era of major military operations to remake other countries. We saw a mission of counterterrorism in Afghanistan, getting the terrorists and stopping attacks, morph into a counterinsurgency, nation building, trying to create a democratic, cohesive, and united Afghanistan, something that has never been done over many centuries of Afghan's history. Moving on from that mindset, and those kind of large-scale troop deployments will make us stronger and more effective and safer at home. And for anyone who gets the wrong idea, let me say clearly, to those who wish America harm, to those who engage in terrorism against us or our allies, know this: the United States will never rest. We will not forgive. We will not forget. We'll hunt you down to the ends of the earth, and you will pay the ultimate price. And let me be clear. We'll continue to support the Afghan people through diplomacy, international influence, and humanitarian aid. We'll continue to push for regional diplomacy engagement to prevent violence and instability. We'll continue to speak out for the basic rights of the Afghan people, especially women and girls, as we speak out for women and girls all around the globe.
And I've been clear that human rights will be the center of our foreign policy. But the way to do that is not through endless military deployments, but through diplomacy, economic tools, and rallying the rest of the world for support. My fellow Americans, the war in Afghanistan is now over. I'm the fourth president who has faced the issue of whether and when to end this war. When I was running for president, I made a commitment to the American people that I would end this war. Today, I've honored that commitment. It was time to be honest with the American people again. We no longer had a clear purpose in an open-ended mission in Afghanistan. After 20 years of war in Afghanistan, I refuse to send another generation of America's sons and daughters to fight a war that should have ended long ago. After more than $2 trillion spent in Afghanistan, a cost that researchers at Brown University estimated would be over $300 million a day for 20 years in Afghanistan, for two decades. Yes, the American people should hear this, $300 million a day for two decades. You take the number of $1 trillion, as many say, that's still $150 million a day for two decades. What have we lost as a consequence in terms of opportunities? I refuse to continue a war that was no longer in the service of the vital national interest of our people. And most of all, after 800,000 Americans serving in Afghanistan, I've traveled that whole country, brave and honorable service. After 20,744 American servicemen and women injured, and the loss of 2,461 American personnel, including 13 lives, lost just this week, I refuse to open another decade of warfare in Afghanistan. We've been a nation too long at war. If you're 20 years old today, you've never known an America at peace. So when I hear that we could have, should have, continued the so-called low-grade effort in Afghanistan at low risk to our service members, at low cost, I don't think enough people understand how much we have asked of the 1% of this country who put that uniform on, willing to put their lives on the line in defense of our nation. Maybe it's because my deceased son, Bo, served in Iraq for a full year. Before that, well, maybe it's because of what I've seen over the years as senator, vice president, and president traveling these countries. A lot of our veterans and their families have gone through hell. Deployment after deployment, months and years away from their families. Missed birthdays, anniversaries, empty chairs at holidays, financial struggles, divorces, loss of limbs, traumatic brain injury, post-traumatic stress. We see it in the struggles many have when they come home. We see it in the strain on their families and caregivers. We see it in the strain on their families when they're not there. We see it in the grief borne by their survivors. The cost of war, they will carry with them their whole lives. Most tragically, we see in the shocking and stunning statistic that should give pause to anyone who thinks war can ever be low grade, low risk, or low cost. 18 veterans on average who die by suicide every single day in America. Not in a far off place, but right here in America. There's nothing low grade or low risk or low cost about any war. It's time to end the war in Afghanistan. As we close 20 years of war and strife and pain and sacrifice, it's time to look to the future, not the past.
to a future that's safer, to a future that's more secure, to a future that honors those who served and all those who gave what President Lincoln called their last full measure of devotion. I give my word with all of my heart. I believe this is the right decision, a wise decision, and the best decision for America. Thank you. Thank you, and may God bless you all, and may God protect our troops.
Well, may God protect the ordinary innocent people of Afghanistan too, actually. I played that. It was about 6-7 minutes long, Martin, because it actually was quite a good speech, really. I mean, if you're going to do something which is humiliating, I mean, I suppose there would have been a lot of time and effort put into preparing a speech for Biden, which is every bit as humiliating as the end of the Vietnam War.
Well, in some respects, more humiliating.
Why?
Why? Because there's more at stake. I mean, the Vietnam War. The Vietnam War was more painful because it's the first time that they lost anything. Now they've actually got the. You know, this is just a reprise in some senses. The speech. I mean, the basic point he's making that we can't go on fighting in Afghanistan is pretty clear. It's obvious. But the Trump administration had negotiated with the Taliban. And they negotiated that they were going to withdraw in May.
What I'm saying is Trump said no more wars, and he actually seems to be, Biden actually seems to be doing it. I mean, he really does. He's saying, look, you know, we're just not having
any. Well, one of the problems that both
Biden... He's putting his money where his mouth is.
Biden and Trump may be saying no more wars, and that may be what the American people want to hear, but that's not what the Pentagon wants to hear. And I suspect that the precipitate withdrawal from Bagram and possibly the bomb attack at Kabul are part of the Pentagon sabotaging. So Biden will not get any... If Biden was able to withdraw from Afghanistan without a major issue, Afghanistan stabilizes and becomes a relatively prosperous place, then the Pentagon will be furious. Afghanistan now, what they did with the Vietnamese after the loss of the Vietnam War is they had sanctions on Vietnam for 20 years. Nobody's allowed any aid or trade or anything. So far from paying compensation to the Vietnamese for smashing the place up, they actually spend 20 years trying to ruin them. And that's probably what's going to happen.
And also using that as a way to negotiate with any new government, saying, yes, look, we will only drop the sanctions if you do as we say.
Basically, yes. So, I mean, when he says the war is over, the war may not be over in Afghanistan. You know, the problem in Afghanistan is that the war just keeps mutating into a different war and another war with a different set of people.
It's great that you say that, Martin, because that's exactly what Scott Ritter is about to talk about. And saying that, well, it starts off with one mission, the mission changes and changes and changes. It transmogrifies into whatever suits the Pentagon once the first excuse. This is very 1984, isn't it? The idea is we're supposed to forget why we were first there. Of course, Afghanistan was supposed to be all about Osama bin Laden hiding in a cave and carrying out 9/11.
Indeed. And even if it was the case that bin Laden did it, and of course bin Laden himself said he didn't do it, the Taliban had said, well, if you give us the evidence and we'll hand him over. But they said, no, we need to invade. And that's because they wanted to invade. Because the real reason for invasion is not because they want anything that's in Afghanistan. It's because they want to stop the Russians, the Chinese, the Pakistanis having what's in Afghanistan. Yeah. So in other words, if you can't win the war on the ground, and of course the war has been won by the contractors, and all that money's talking about $300 million a day, most of that money went back into the pockets of contractors in the US.
In July,
none of it was spent in Afghanistan, or a tiny fraction of it.
In July 2001, William Cooper, Bill Cooper, on his radio show in the United States said, bin Laden, they're going to be blaming something on him. This was after there was a CNN interview with bin Laden in a cave in Afghanistan for the US population, saying, well, CNN have tracked him down, the CIA couldn't find him, so obviously the CIA were running him. And Bill, with his naval intelligence background, said, well, this guy is about to be set up for something, some sort of big attack on the United States is going to be blamed on him. But at the end of the day, I mean, I did a thing on in 2011 when they had this Aborto bad where they supposedly killed bin Laden. Martin, I think there's quite a lot of evidence that he died around the time of the 9/11 attacks, actually, because he had a kidney complaint.
That's right. And at the time, it was reported in The Guardian that in November No, was it November? Yes. He was still in contact with his CIA handlers, according to the French sources.
So this is after 9/11, you're saying, or not?
I can't remember the timeline. Not sure when. I can't remember the timeline, and I'd need to look it up.
He did have a serious kidney illness.
Oh, he did. Yes,
back in 2001.
That's right. Yes,
but he was supposed to have lasted another 10 years. A lot of people believe that he died actually way back. Just after the turn of the century.
The Abbottabad incident, as I call it, if you talk to anybody from Pakistan or people who drive taxis or run shops around in Bristol, nobody believes a word of that. Nobody believes a word of that at all.
If I remember rightly, you had a chat with John Snow from Channel 4 News, face-to-face chat about this. So just a quick little...
I think it was before the invasion of Afghanistan. Because I'd seen in The Guardian that, not that long ago, there had been, this was according to the French secret services, that there had been a meeting in Doha, I think it was, where bin Laden was in hospital, and the CIA had turned up with a get well card and some flowers for him.
Exploding flowers?
Well, no. I don't know, but anyway, because it had been reported on Channel 4 News, I then saw Jon Snow at the cinema, and I went up to him and buttonholed him.
This is in Notting Hill.
You wouldn't normally do that. If people are on a night out, you don't want to just buttonhole them, but I thought I'm going to buttonhole him about this because I'm interested. I said, you reported that there had been a meeting between the CIA and bin Laden, not that long ago, in a hospital in Doha.
I think it was Dubai. Actually.
Dubai,
but anyway,
that's right.
The American hospital in Dubai. Yeah.
Yes, and the source was the French secret services. And he said, yes, but we only ran the story because we checked it with the British doctor who had actually carried out the operation. So that's what he told me.
Mm. So at that point, bin Laden was, a life-threatening injury, although I suppose you can carry on with one kidney.
But more important to the point is that he was still very much in cahoots with the CIA literally weeks before the so-called 9/11 attack, or his involvement in the 9/11 attack.
Okay, so what about this Saudi connection? Because although of course, bin Laden was over in Afghanistan, he wasn't an Afghan, he was a Saudi, and the hijackers on 9/11, supposed hijackers, were also Saudis.
Well, that's right. And, of course, ultimately, it's leaving aside all these ins and outs, the basic contours of what's going on is clear. The Saudi Mukhabarat works with Western Intelligence Service to set up Al-Qaeda
to fight the
Russians in Afghanistan, the Soviets in Afghanistan. Everybody accepts that. There's no dispute about it. And the story is that this whole international brigade of Islamist terrorists, which we armed and trained, they were trained by our special forces with your taxes, British people listening to the show. They suddenly turned on us and decided that they were going to attack us. And then we've got to go to war to invade Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Syria, all the rest of it.
Now, 7 countries now, in 5 years.
Yeah, but the very least you could say about that is, are we going to hear sorry from any of you about arming and training these people in the first place? As Madeleine Albright said, well, what's more important, a few stirred-up Muslims or the destruction of the Soviet Union? Come on. And, of course, even if everything they say was true, that would still be a big question to ask. Was it worth setting up Al-Qaeda in order to destroy the Soviet Union? Because they freely admit that they did set it up. I mean, as Robin Cook, when he, God rest him, said when he was Foreign Secretary, everybody knows that the word Al-Qaeda means the base, and it means the database that was held in Jordan by the Western powers of all the people that had been trained and sent to Afghanistan. That's what it was. Well, that's where the word Al-Qaeda comes from.
This Charlie Wilson's war business, it all started, didn't it? Operation Cyclone in Afghanistan, and it's taken on a life of its own to places like Yugoslavia, obviously much more recently in places like Libya and Syria.
Yes, well, the point is that you could argue that this is an unintended effect of their meddling and their stupidity. Now, even that should mean that they should hang their heads in shame and many of them should go to prison. But it's worse than that. As anybody who's been following things in Syria over the last decade will know, we are still working with Al-Qaeda. It's not as if we've suddenly decided we're against them and we're now going to hunt them down, even though we trained them in the first place. In Syria, they're still being trained and directed by British military personnel.
And also the funding. Let's look at the funding for a moment, because Scott Bennett, the former psychological warfare officer in the US, has absolutely blown the whistle on that, going through Swiss banks like UBS to get money to these people that we're supposed to be fighting every day on the national news bulletins.
Well, that's right. I mean, there are various levels of this where you could just, even if we accept their version of events, they are attempting to evade responsibility for what they've done. But of course, it's worse than that. And of course, it's not just us here on People's Republic of Soapscroft talking about these things. We're going to hear from Scott Ritter, former US Marine colonel, in a minute. But of course, you can imagine that the Russian Marine colonels, Chinese Marine colonels, and Iranian Marine colonels know what we know and have a lot more.
They don't seem to make so much of a big fuss about this in order to sort of almost con the criminals here in the West into thinking that they don't know about
it's quite clever, actually. Well, if you think about it, that's if you knew what was going on, you don't necessarily go, oh, God, that's terrible. You just make sure you know what's going on, and then, you know, you make your plans accordingly, don't you?
And hopefully the people that have been doing these things, the deep state NATO intelligence services, will be wrong-footed by thinking that you don't know stuff you do know. Anyway, someone that does know what's going on, he picks up the story of Osama bin Laden, the 9/11 attacks 20 years ago in Afghanistan, looking at exactly who they were tracking down, bin Laden, in this cave in Afghanistan, and why they were there in the first place.
Let's start off by, again, using what I talked about in the arms control world, how a problem is framed. Understand that problems can be reframed as they progress, that you can start with the intention of doing something, and then later on, as the situation develops, you'll reframe your objectives. And that's what happened in Afghanistan. It was just a continuous reframing of objectives. We started actually with a very pure operation, wrongheaded, I believe, but pure, meaning that the United States was attacked by terrorists on 9/11. Thousands of Americans and people of other nationalities were killed on that date. And the president determined that we would seek revenge against those who perpetrated the attack. It was determined that Al-Qaeda, an organization, the base, headed by a gentleman named Osama bin Laden, was responsible. And we decided that we were going to go into Afghanistan, where Osama bin Laden resided, together with the bulk of his Al-Qaeda organization, and we were going to annihilate him.
Well, hang on, that doesn't make any sense, because he's a Saudi, and almost all the hijackers were Saudis.
But he lived in Afghanistan. We're not going after Saudis. We were going after Osama bin Laden. And we were going after the Al-Qaeda organization, which was based out of, at least the main party of it, was based out of Afghanistan. So that's why we went there. And again, they were there as guests of this organization called the Taliban, which at the time was the government of Afghanistan, although at the time only a few nations recognized it as such. Most nations recognized it as this mob of Islamic fundamentalists who had been engaged in a civil war with other elements in Afghanistan, and whose ruling methodology was deemed to be medieval in nature, especially when it came to women. And the Taliban, being based out of Kandahar originally, which is in southern Afghanistan, is primarily a Pashto organization, meaning they're from the Pashto tribes. And they had invited bin Laden and his Al-Qaeda members to Afghanistan after bin Laden had been chased out of other nations, Saudi Arabia, Sudan. They brought him in under what's called Pashtunwali, which is a very complex tribal code that basically says, when we bring you in and bring you under our protection, we guarantee your protection. But there's a two-sided street to that, meaning that while you're under our protection, you cannot violate the rules, the norms, the standards of the Pashtun tribes and of Islamic law. And when 9/11 occurred, The Taliban actually did reach out and talk with the United States through intermediaries and others and say, hey, if bin Laden and al-Qaeda did what you say he did, he's violated Pashtunwali. And this is unacceptable. And while we won't turn him over to you, we will turn him over to a third party for Islamic justice, and we will evict al-Qaeda from Afghanistan if you just show us the proof that he was involved. But, you know, at that point in time, we were in the business of stacking bodies. It wasn't about getting a just outcome. It was about getting an outcome that that made Americans feel good. And in order to do that, we had to kill people. We had to kill a lot of people. And no better way to kill a lot of people than expand our war in Afghanistan to include not just bin Laden and al-Qaeda, but now all of the Taliban. So our war transformed. It went from simply hunting down al-Qaeda to now destroying the Taliban and removing them from power. And when you opt to remove a government from power, you create a vacuum that you are now obligated to fill. And in doing so, you've now incurred a nation-building requirement, a nation-building task. And that's what happened. That's how we went from simply trying to kill Osama bin Laden to being neck deep in a nation-building exercise in Afghanistan. It didn't start out that way, but that's the way it ended it up.
Yeah, but hang on a minute. The Taliban are potentially your allies, helping you round up the mastermind of 9/11, and you decide you're going to, instead of working with them to get hold of him, you're going to attack them, one organization in the world that can actually help you to get hold of the perpetrator of 9/11.
Look, this is, in a nutshell, you just described the debate I had with Richard Holbrooke, who later on became the czar, so to speak, of Afghan-Pakistan relations under Obama. But, you know, I basically, in a debate I had with him on the History Channel in October of 2001, I said, look, the best policy we can have here is avoid putting American boots on the ground, and instead work with the Taliban to isolate al-Qaeda, Osama bin Laden, and get him removed. This also means we need to work with Afghanistan's neighbors, the Pakistanis, the Iranians, the various former Soviet republics, to work with us so that when they receive bin Laden, we can be assured that he will be treated in a manner which prevents him ever again threatening the United States. This will require us to work with moderate elements within the Taliban. And Holbrooke laughed and said, there are no moderate Taliban. Well, he didn't know what he was talking about. There were moderate Taliban at the time. A guy named Mudawakil was the foreign minister. He was moderate. He was surrounded by others who were moderate. And even Mullah Omar, who was the leader, is the one who said, you know, if you violate Pashtunwali, you will pay a price. But no, the problem was, see, what I'm laying out here to you about respecting Pashtun tribal culture, respecting Pashtunwali, and respecting people to adhere to a code that has defined their life requires a level of understanding of the cultural norms and history of that region that the average American politician lacks, and the average American is ill-equipped to embrace readily. After 9/11, the American people weren't prepared to sit down and be lectured to by people like me about how the best way forward to avoid a quagmire would be to negotiate with the Taliban, to work with the Taliban, to neutralize bin Laden in a manner that reduced collateral damage, reduced potential harm to Americans, reduced potential harm to innocent Afghan civilians. That would require a lot of explaining. And one thing I learned in the military early on when I was standing in front of a general explaining that what I did was actually right, he shut me up. He said, Lieutenant, when you're explaining, you're losing. And the fact that you're standing here before me today explaining something means you lost. Get out of my office. This is true for American politicians. The moment they start explaining something to their constituency, they've lost. They can't get involved in complex discussions with their constituents, especially after such an event as 9/11, where what people wanted was revenge. Bloodlust was up. It was easier to tell the American people, we're going in, we're going to wade into Afghanistan, and we're going to slaughter bin Laden, we're going to slaughter al-Qaeda, we're going to slaughter the Taliban. And the American people would thump their chests, give three or four oohs, and say, this is great, as opposed to saying, hey, I know you guys want blood, but this is what we're going to do. We're going to actually hold back on the troops, and we're going to engage in this process that might take a couple months to explain to bin Laden, or explain to Mullah Omar and the Taliban why bin Laden's a bad guy. And then bin Laden will be transferred to a third party, and then it's going to probably take us a couple more months to get an outcome that is satisfactory to us. You'd be cut off at the knees the second you started having that conversation with the American people in the 2001, the post 9/11, 2001, 2002 timeframe. It was much easier just to say, no, we're sending the boys in, we're stacking bodies, because that's something the American people understood, and that's something they were prepared to undertake.
Yeah, but you see, sometimes in situations like September the 11th attacks, the response might be far worse than the attacks themselves, and actually send the nation or the world on a collision course, and actually into a disastrous area, particularly when deciding, right, we're just going to tear up the rule book of the UN and start doing regime changes here, there, and everywhere. And also, of course, there is the fact that we know now there are some quite serious questions about 9/11 as to whether bin Laden from his cave in Afghanistan was really the mastermind. Now we know about the collapse of Building 7, which wasn't hit by a plane. We also know about the complete non-appearance, it seems, of the United States Air Force in intercepting those jets, and the collapse of the, you know, most supposedly the best prepared and most powerful air defense in the world, Scott.
Well, I'm not going to get into 9/11. What I will say is that if you wanted to take out the masterminds of 9/11, the place to bomb would have been Hamburg, Germany, because that's where 9/11 was planned, according to the narrative that the U.S. government itself promotes. So, you know, going into Afghanistan was absurd. And I think one of the big lessons of this whole 20-year fiasco is if we don't get it right at the start, you know, the end result can be far worse than the event that initiated it. And I think that when we take a look at the totality of our 20-year debacle in Afghanistan, that harmed America and the world far more than the events of 9/11 did.
Now, I know you say you don't want to get into that, but I think you need to just explain, even it, just a couple of paragraphs, what you mean by Germany, because certainly, I've heard all sorts of things about the 9/11 attacks, most of them to do with them being organized from Afghanistan, not Germany.
Well, I mean, that is a narrative, the organized from Afghanistan is a narrative that's promoted by the debriefings of people like Sheikh Mohammed and others who have been captured and tortured and imprisoned in Guantanamo Bay. But when we trace the 19 hijackers, they operated out of Hamburg, Germany. They operated out of a mosque. The money was brought together there, and the 19 hijackers were shipped from there around to the various locations. I mean, I'm grossly oversimplifying this, but to me, the notion that 9/11 was planned in a cave somewhere in Afghanistan is ludicrous. We know that bin Laden was aware of 9/11. I think there's some evidence that he talked about something happening, but the notion that he planned it, that he sat there and said, no, we're going to specifically train you guys to do X to accomplish Y. I think at least the narrative that is promulgated by the United States supports, Hamburg as being the planning center for 9/11.
Well, that is definitely worth thinking about. The next time we see some sort of mass terror attack, a bit like the September 11th or anything like that, God forbid, happening again, we should be extremely wary about what we're being told at the time is the cause, and who has done it and where it's been done from, because it seems to me quite often we hear afterwards quite a lot more information than we're getting at the time. And I'm also a little bit suspicious when, you know, all the dots are joined within the first 24 hours, Scott.
Well, look, first of all, absolutely. When you claim to have absolute certainty of knowledge about, about an event that has yet to be totally comprehended, you need to be suspicious. I always operate under the notion that you can't solve a problem until you first properly define it. And what happened with our desire for revenge in Afghanistan is that we came up with a solution without first understanding exactly what occurred. I mean, it seems to me that we should have allowed a 9/11 type commission to reach a more defined understanding of what exactly happened before we started talking about taking the nation to war. But no, we rushed to judgment. And again, it's because, what happened after 9/11 was very political. I mean, we only have to listen to, people who talk about Paul Wolfowitz sitting down with the president on September 12th, talking about exploiting the events of 9/11 to carry out regime change in Iraq. There were no Iraqis on board any of those aircraft. Iraq had nothing to do with this. Iraq was a sworn enemy of al-Qaeda. And yet, here we have senior government officials talking about using 9/11 as an excuse to initiate a war of regime change with Iraq. So, yes, you're right. We need to be extraordinarily skeptical, and we have a duty and responsibility as citizens to demand answers from our government before they take us down a path of, in the case of Afghanistan, a 20-year, disaster.
Okay, so what was Afghanistan really about, and why, as NATO, the U.S. leading the Brits, etc., out? Why now?
Well, I mean, 9/11. If again, we trace it back in the immediate aftermath. The United States put a tremendous amount of pressure on NATO to execute Article 5 to say that since the United States has been attacked, NATO is now going to come to our collective self-defense. And NATO, like the compliant puppy dog that they are, they did this. And it's the only time that Article 5 has been implemented. And, NATO aircraft came to the United States. They had AWACS aircraft flying over, like we really needed a NATO AWACS airplane here. And they did some other things in terms of putting up boats in the Mediterranean. They had naval patrols to keep terrorists out coming from North Africa, et cetera. That was all under Article 5. And then we went to the United Nations, and again, we used the pain and suffering of those people who died on 9/11 to twist the United Nations into passing a series of Security Council resolutions authorizing the use of force to go into Afghanistan and stabilize the region, to begin nation building. And NATO bought into this. NATO said, well, we have that. So NATO implemented another paragraph of the NATO treaty, which is Article 4. And it's instead of collective self-defense, it means we can use military power to promote the security needs of a member state as needed. And so under Article 4, NATO started dispatching troops using this United Nations resolution as a cover to carry out anti-terrorism, counterterrorism, and nation-building exercises. These things called provincial reconstruction teams were dispatched and used to build up infrastructure, to create governance, to train troops, etc. And that's how NATO got involved. They got involved via the vehicle of international law. I mean, the one thing we can't say about the Afghan intervention early on is that it violated international law. Actually, it was one of the most legitimate, quote unquote, military interventions in modern history, because it had basically crossed all the T's and dotted all the I's when it came to international law. We had the United Nations. We had NATO. We had everything, brought in. Everybody supported it. the whole world supported going in there and basically rebuilding Afghanistan. What they didn't support is what the United States did after that. You see, after we brought everybody in and said, hey, we're going to let you build, reconstruct all this stuff, and we need you to work under a unified command structure, we're going to keep this other command structure in place, the counterterrorism command structure, and we're just going to go around and do whatever we want, including assassinating people, the hunt for bin Laden. We couldn't trust to an international organization. The CIA came in and recruited basically a private army The British intelligence services came in and recruited their own army. And we did this all as separate from the Afghan government that we were trying to build, meaning that all these private secret Afghan armies that we built weren't responsive to the Afghan government. They're responsive to the CIA or British MI6 or American Special Operations, but they weren't responsive to the Afghan government. And the operations they carried out undermined the legitimacy of the Afghan government and the legitimacy of the nation building work that NATO was undertaking. So the United States invited everybody in, told them to do X, and then we did Y and undermined everything they were trying to do. I mean, that, you know, that just shows you the insanity of what was going on in Afghanistan.
Yeah, but what was it really about? I know the Taliban, for example, had stopped the growing of poppies. I mean, if it wasn't about hunting down bin Laden in a cave, there must have been something more to it. I mean, certainly looking at it, one of the aspects to it is the absolutely massive increase in opium production there.
Well, here's the deal. I mean, the United States, when the CIA first came in, prior to 9/11, we already had a relationship with certain tribal elements in Afghanistan as part of our war against the Taliban. We were supporting this entity called the Northern Alliance. We were providing them with millions of dollars, and all that. And then when we intervened after 9/11 and the Taliban started to collapse, we immediately went in and started to recruit these militias that used to be allied with the Taliban, but now we bought them off. And the CIA never allowed many of these militias to be disbanded and to report to the Afghan government that we're rebuilding. Instead, we basically allowed these militias to govern over vast regions of Afghanistan and do what they wanted to do, which included growing opium or growing poppies and producing opium that was converted into heroin and stuff, and making millions of dollars doing that. This was the way that we paid off these tribal elements to remain loyal to the CIA. So that's what happened. The Taliban, when we invaded, the Taliban had pretty much eradicated poppy harvesting in Afghanistan. Then we empowered these tribal elements, and that's all they did. And then what we did is, in order to win the loyalty or keep the loyalty of certain tribal elements, they said, well, wait a minute, this tribe over there is growing poppies right now, and they're competing with us. We need that to end. So we'd come in with a poppy eradication program, but we weren't eradicating poppies. We were eradicating the competition of the poppy growers that we were supporting. That's just the crazy way that we were, some people say that we were manipulating Afghan tribal politics, but I would say that we're being manipulated by Afghan tribal politics, meaning that, we weren't necessarily the ones calling the shots here. We were getting used by these extremely corrupt tribal leaders who made millions off of money they received directly from the CIA, but they made even more money off of growing poppies that was converted into opium.
Now, Afghanistan couldn't really be much further away from the United States of America, Scott. It's a bit difficult to justify the idea that this rather backward country is really that much of a threat to the superpower that is based in, has got Washington as its capital. Obviously it's in an interesting place on the world island geopolitically. You've got Iran next door, you've got Russia next door, you've got Pakistan. I mean, surely this is, there's some geopolitics involved here rather than just the idea that you've got these, particularly, well, there must be wonder terrorists in Afghanistan that are threatening the United States.
No, you're correct. First of all, understand that Afghanistan, we call it a nation, but it's not a nation in the traditional sense. A nation is a specific geographical entity where the population is united in a vision that reflects the will of the totality of the people involved. Afghanistan is the exact opposite. It's a conglomerate of tribes that don't necessarily get along with one another, all of whom occupy this ungovernable space. It's a nation only because its borders are defined by the ability of these ungovernable people to push back against their neighbors and prevent them from occupying them, as opposed to them trying to push out their borders and define it. So it's basically this ungovernable space. But it is located in a very, critical part of the world. It's a bridge between, for instance, Iran, Pakistan, and China, Iran, Pakistan, and India, through the former Soviet republics. You get into Russia. You also have the Silk Road that leads across into Europe. So it's positioned. And what we know is that this positioning is of strategic importance. We know this. Why? Because first Jimmy Carter and then Ronald Reagan met with the Taliban met with Afghans to negotiate a pipeline that would transit Afghanistan to bring oil from the Central Asian republics into India. We were in negotiation with them prior to 9/11. During the 1980s, we were discussing this with them all the way through into the 1990s. So the notion that we didn't know anything about Afghanistan prior to this is absurd. We also knew that Afghanistan was sitting on one of the world's largest reserves of exotic metals. And during the time, they've only recently gained importance because they're critical to electronics. But that's there. So, there is, a material wealth and element to that. But also, there's an element that if you can stabilize Afghanistan and use Afghanistan as part and parcel, sort of a glue to link these Eurasian nations together, Iran, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, Russia, China, Pakistan, India, and link them all together, you've created a center of gravity that directly competes with the transatlantic alliance between the United States and Europe. So it's in America's interests to continue to destabilize Afghanistan, because as long as Afghanistan's destabilized, you can't have this Eurasian linkage. And so, yes, there's a huge geopolitical element to Afghanistan that goes beyond simply bin Laden was there and launched a terror attack. We would have had a hard time explaining to the American people why we were in Afghanistan without the 9/11 attacks. But once the 9/11 attacks occurred and we got into Afghanistan, we allowed ourselves to be sucked into this geopolitical vortex without really understanding how we wanted to emerge. I think that's one of the problems, is we never really had a good end game on how this was going to end.
Well, that's a very interesting analysis. And as I would have expected from him, you can see what he's doing with the questions about 9/11, because being an ex-US military officer and so on, and of course he's aware of how the US politics works, he can't keep a platform to talk about things if he starts talking at that level. So we've got to put that aside. I'm pretty confident that he does understand about that stuff, but he doesn't want to talk about it. You're pressing him on it, but he's quite professionally saying, I'm not going down that road, because he's trying to show the American people that, you've made a mistake here, rather than, this is actually an evil plot, as it were.
But I think some of the most interesting stuff he was saying, loads of interesting, I think, for me, I learned a lot listening to Scott. He seems to have a very deep insight into the customs of the area. But it's this whole idea that the idea of being there is just, it's this divide and ruin, Dan Glazebrook book idea, that it could become, as he said there, a centre of gravity geopolitically for an opposition to the transatlantic alliance.
Okay, let's deal with that. Don't forget that the intervention in Afghanistan didn't begin in 2001. It began in the late 1970s. And Brzezinski openly said that we didn't support the Mujahideen after the Soviets invaded Afghanistan. What happened was there was a coup against the monarchy in Afghanistan, and the military officers that carried out the coup, similar to kind of coups that had taken place in Libya and Egypt and other places, they wanted to modernize the country. and they had a secular philosophy, and they were influenced by Marxist ideas. And obviously, they wanted to try and do things like educate women, carry out a land reform, you know, and modernize the country, bringing in electricity into the villages, all of that sort of stuff. And from the get-go, the Western powers, working through the Pakistanis, stirred up the rural population, particularly in southern Afghanistan, to resist the central government in Kabul. And not only to resist passively, but basically to, you know, kill people, shoot police officers. Women teachers, for example, were a major target of the Mujahideen, because we don't believe in women education, so any women teachers, we're going to kill them. And we paid for that, folks. We in this country, in Britain, we paid for Operation Cyclone. MI6 were deeply involved. They were the lead agency, because the British are regarded within the Western Alliance as being the experts on Islamic countries.
Glorious Rory Stewart, the Tory MP who was chairing the Defence Select Committee when I did an article about him, the Bilderberger, chairing the deciding where all the money is spent in the British military. So he was over there. He was definitely exposed. I mean, we did it on this show probably 2 or 3 years ago now, actually. No. Well, when the leadership elections, 2019, mid-2019, that he was working for MI6. But look, what about Brzezinski? We heard a little bit from him. But, I mean, the grand chessboard,
yeah,
the book.
But
also, of course, Brzezinski was involved, wasn't he? Negotiating on the Pakistan-Afghan border, just to make sure that the US knew where the future was going to go, which was US-controlled, extremist, Islamist elements in there, in order to deny that place to the Russians.
Yes, exactly. So I don't suppose Scott would...
Sorry, Martin, to interrupt you again, but he also wrote, didn't he, about what we need is a new Pearl Harbor.
That wasn't him.
Wasn't it?
No, the new Pearl Harbor is from the... what's it called? The... PNAC, you know, the Project for a New American Century. So Brzezinski is not directly linked to that, although he's very, you know, he's got similar attitudes. Brzezinski, of course, was a Democrat, whereas the PNAC people were all Republicans. But they're all part of the US foreign policy establishment, which is quite a narrow clique, really. So he persuaded Carter that what we're going to do is we're going to support the Mujahideen against the government of Afghanistan. They weren't an elected government. You know, the elections in Afghanistan, you know, there's been attempted elections since we invaded, but before that, there's never been any elections. So people, I mean, the way Afghanistan works as a very decentralized, not very technological place is local leaders run local areas and then they do deals with other local leaders. That's how things work and has done for centuries. So this modernizing government in Afghanistan wanted to improve things, and they represented kind of middle class aspirations in the towns. But of course, the vast majority of the population live in rural areas, very conservative lifestyle, very conservative politics and social attitudes. And they were able to be stirred up quite easily by the ISI and with Saudi money. And they began attacking the Afghan government's officials and so on. So the Afghan government then turned to the Russians and said, we're trying to modernize the country, but we've got all these pesky rebels in the rural areas who are sort of shooting our police officers and women teachers and so on. Will you help us? And the Russians, rather reluctantly, I think there was actually a coup within the coup, where a more extreme faction of the coup plotters had taken over, and they thought that they were going to create more problems. So the Russians actually invaded reluctantly to push out this more extreme faction in the hope that they could just stabilize the situation. Because don't forget, Afghanistan is right next to them, as it was. It would be as if there was a coup in Mexico, yeah, or for us, you know, a coup in Ireland or whatever. It's right next door. So they've got to say, they can't just ignore it. And then, of course, what happened in the White House, and we've got all this, it's all on the record, they cheered when the Soviets invaded, because the purpose of supporting these Mujahideen rebels against the government was exactly to provoke a Russian invasion, Soviet invasion. And Brzezinski said, what we're going to do now is we're going to give them back. We're going to punish them for what they did to us in Vietnam. This is going to be their version. And sure enough, it was. It took 10 years. But the Soviet army was beaten, had to withdraw, and it ultimately led to the collapse of the Soviet Union, which was regarded as a massive success inside the Beltway in Washington, and no doubt within MI6, etc. But of course, that then created a civil war between the Mujahideen factions. So they don't care about that, frankly. I mean, it didn't mean much to them. But from the point of view of the Pakistani ISI, having the civil war going on in Afghanistan was, you know, again, they're now basically running the show, and they built up the Taliban as a means of, because the Taliban, of course, because they've got an Islamist ideology, are somewhat above the tribal politics of Afghanistan. The same thing was true of the Islamic Courts Union in Somalia, because they've got very big clan politics there. But if you've got young people who've got a wider ideology, you can do something, you know, to squash, you know.
The reason we're going into a lot of this in some real depth here is because of this whole kind of grand chessboard concept.
Yeah,
very important.
Well, that was his book. It's called The Grand Chessboard.
That's right, Brzezinski's book. And it's because really what he was doing there was plotting out the next 50, 60 years of world history.
Yes, and Brzezinski was very influenced by Mackinder, who's the, you know, the British geographer who talked about the heartland theory and who controls the heartland control. And basically what we're talking about is, if you think about history, Asian empires have been superseded by maritime empires based initially in Spain and Portugal, then in Holland, then in Britain, and then following on to the United States. Yeah. So you've got this, what you might call, they're called thalassocratic regimes based on naval power, yeah? Whereas traditionally empires in Asia are land empires, but created by land.
They don't need to really bother about anything on the sea because there's so little of it. Actually, almost all of it, of course, is, you know, not sea. Most of the countries are not necessarily.
That's right.
Haven't got a sea border.
That's right. But at the same time, I mean, of course, there's a lot of historical discussion about this, because the Chinese Ming Emperor sent a massive fleet to sail into the Indian Ocean, and long before the Portuguese and the Spanish came in there, but the China is so big and self-contained that when he fell from power, the new regime decided it wasn't interested in doing anything with the sea at all. So they just wrecked all the ships, and because they've got enough to manage with, you know, it's a big country. There's lots of things there that they do, and we don't, you know, and when the British arrived in the 18th century, and they said, we've got all this stuff, and the Kangxi Emperor
would
said,
you like to trade with us?
And they said, well, we're not interested in your stuff.
We don't need any of it. Thank you. Goodbye.
Yeah.
Anyway,
that wasn't actually true, apparently. Apparently he was actually interested. He was pretending that he wasn't. But nevertheless, I mean, we're getting into...
Inscrutable.
Yes. We're now getting into a wider...
Yeah, well, discussion. Let's get back to the present, because the question I asked Scott Ritter there, which he didn't answer, I pressed him on. Why now?
I believe in Occam's razor, meaning the simplest explanation is usually the correct one. Let's put it this way. During the administration of George W. Bush, during the administration of Barack Obama, that's 16 years, you know, we weren't getting out of Afghanistan. We, you know, everybody struggled to define what the mission was. There were various surges, various redefining of what we were doing there. Troop levels went up, troop levels went down. Even after we killed bin Laden in 2011, we still weren't talking about getting out of there. We were heavily invested in the region, because I do think that some people started to understand the geopolitical significance of being in Afghanistan. And had a traditional American politician, for instance, had Hillary Clinton won the election in 2016, we'd still be in Afghanistan today, because she's a traditional American imperial hegemony promoting type politician. But this guy named Donald Trump won, who doesn't operate from any book that's recognized by the American establishment. And early on, he went to the generals, and he almost got sucked into the trap. The generals and the warmongers all sat down and told him how important Afghanistan was. And if they just gave him more troops and just gave him more money, they could win this thing and it would be great. And he said, okay, here's your troops. Here's your money. I'm going to loosen up rules of engagement. You can kill anybody you want to kill. Just get the job done. And then he went to him a year later and said, how's it going? And they said, well, we need more troops and more money. And He was the most honest American politician we had in a long time. He looked at the generals. He looked at Mattis, Mad Dog Mattis, the Secretary of Defense, former Marine, with extensive history in Afghanistan, and he called them losers. He says, you guys can't win a war. You don't know how to win a war. You're a bunch of losers. I gave you everything you asked for, and all I get is the same. We're out of here. And he made the decision that we're getting unplugged because he didn't buy into all the other stuff that all the other politicians had, you know, had said why we need to be there. All he said is, this is an unpopular war. We have troops over there that don't need to be there, and I'm bringing them home. And he began a process of negotiating with the Taliban, which, again, broke many, many rules, and actually negotiated a peace agreement and came up with a date of withdrawal, which was May of 2021. And the whole establishment went crazy. They just didn't buy into it. We know this because he gave a direct order to the military to pull the troops down to a certain level. And we found out after he lost the election that the military just shelved that order. And instead of reducing troops, actually reinforced them. So there were more troops in Afghanistan than less troops when Donald Trump left office, because the establishment didn't want to get out of Afghanistan. That's just a reality. Now, Joe Biden is Mr. Establishment, but he was confronted with a predicament because he had this peace treaty, this peace agreement. And the Taliban were actually living up to the part of the agreement that said, we won't kill Americans as long as you're getting out. And Biden was also somebody who didn't believe in this mission long term. When he was vice president, he continuously told Barack Obama that he was against surging people in. He was against promoting a continuous conflict. So he saw this as an opportunity to get out. The question is, how do we get out and when do we get out? And Biden made the decision that the best way to get out is just to get out. He tried to get agreement within his administration. They had serious meetings in March because the May deadline was coming up. And by April, he overrode everybody and said, no, we're getting out. Yes, I will tell the Taliban we need an extension of this, but we're getting out. Then he went to NATO and he told NATO, we're getting out. And he set the date. We will be out by September 11th, 2021. Now, the interesting thing about this is that was a decision he made. Now, the politician comes in. We now know that, A, he was negotiating extensively with the Taliban, that there was a deal cut between him and the Taliban on how this was going to unravel. Two, he knew that the Afghan government would collapse. He had a phone conversation with the Afghan president in March where the president said, hey, man, we're being invaded. This is all over. It's all she wrote unless you do something. And he said, what I need you to do is go out there and be positive about this, create a perception of success, even if it's not true. So Biden was telling the Afghan president to lie about the situation so that he could shape perception in the United States so that we could go forward with this withdrawal. Of course, it all came to a head when the Afghan government did, in fact, collapse. The Taliban took over the country, and now we're stuck basically, you know, holding the bag, and we had to go in and negotiate in the theater of the absurd, where we would deploy 6,000 troops into the most indefensible space in all of Afghanistan, and who were totally dependent upon the mercy of the Taliban not to slaughter them, and then undertake this this humanitarian fiasco, which we called an evacuation, that resulted in an act of terror that killed 13 Americans. Over 100, I think 170 Afghans, and now we have this debacle where America's out of Afghanistan, and it looks as though the Taliban won. They did win, but that's how it happened. It was basically, just poorly executed policy. I don't see, and England learned the hard way that when you're the poodle of the United States, unfortunately, when we say heal, you have to heal. England didn't have a choice. They have no power projection capability. They've got nothing. They can protest all they want, but at the end of the day, England had to do what the United States told them to do in Afghanistan, which is get in here, get your people out, and get out of here with us. So did the rest of Europe. Nobody had the ability to say no to the United States because the United States is the master, and they're just a bunch of puppies that follow the direction that their master tells them to go.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, we had our Puma helicopters in there, and the British Royal Air Force didn't actually have the transport capability, big enough aircraft to bring those helicopters out. So we had to actually hire a massive aircraft from the Russians to get our aircraft out, which is ironic. But look, looking at it now, I mean, what you're describing there is an absolutely colossal humiliation that really does spell doom, I suppose, for any credibility for the NATO forces, and particularly for the United States as a world power.
Yes, if we lived in a world that was governed by rational thinkers, that's true. First of all, the United States is not going to learn any lesson from Afghanistan, just like we didn't learn any lesson from Vietnam. There will be a period of time where we lick our wounds, and you know, where there's some bitterness and recrimination, etc. But we will always continue to operate in the way that we have to operate in order to sustain who we are and what we are as a nation. We are a nation that is totally dependent upon our ability to dictate outcomes to the rest of the world, on our ability to gain access to resources we need to survive as a nation, and guarantee that we acquire these resources at prices that are affordable to us without overly enriching you. We are a global empire, and until the empire totally collapses, this is the way the United States will operate, and it compels us to behave in a certain manner. And we will do this, and the world will accept this until the world can come up with the appropriate means of pushing back, whether this is a revitalized Russia, whether this is a revitalized China, whether this is a Russian-Chinese alliance, whether this is a Eurasian entity that emerges from a post-Afghan environment, whether it's a combination of the three. Until there's sufficient pushback to keep the United States from behaving in this fashion, this is what the United States is going to do. Yeah, it's humiliating. So is Vietnam. We recovered from that. We'll recover from this.
Scott, your books, your latest book, can you just let our listeners know what it is, where they can get it?
Well, the latest book is it's called Scorpion King. It's a history of America's addiction to nuclear weapons, from FDR to Donald Trump. It's published by Clarity Press. You can get it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, any of the online booksellers.
Okay, Scott Ritter, thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
So, Scott Ritter there, Martin, saying, basically taking us through, really this is, sounds to me, from what he's saying, is this was Donald Trump's work, which was really picked up and embraced by Joe Biden.
Yeah, well, he also pointed out that Biden was opposed to Petraeus's surge during the Obama administration. And Obama was basically, I mean, everybody who tries to get elected in the United States promises the punters that they're going to end the wars. Yeah, even Nixon promised that he was going to end the war in Vietnam, but with honour, as opposed to dishonour or whatever. So, because they went in on a kind of rage factor, which he discussed in the first interview, once that rage factor's gone, they just want to go home. They don't care about Afghanistan, really. As he said, they just want a load of bodies to get the revenge for 9/11. So the politics in the US is pretty, it's pretty childlike, frankly. But I mean, so if you want to get elected, Obama promised it, Trump promised it, Biden promised it. We're going to end the wars, all these foreign wars.
What about this whole business of the end of the US empire now, the humiliation?
Well, listen, the US empire may have been defeated in Afghanistan, but Afghanistan is, as you pointed out, a very poor, backward country, a long way away from where the major power centres in the world are. So that doesn't mean that the US is going to, what Biden's thinking and the war faction in the US are now thinking is, what we really need to do is reconfigure to take down the Russians and the Chinese. And if we're bogged down in Afghanistan, I mean, the Chinese and the Russians got an obvious way to hit back at us if they don't like what we're doing. So, for example, if there had been a war with the Russians, yeah, quite possible, could have happened, then don't forget that the US military in Afghanistan are dependent upon trains carrying food from Europe to feed their troops in Afghanistan. They don't eat the local stuff. Yeah, so they're actually in a very exposed position there. If there is a major war with Iran and with Russia and China, any US and British military forces in Afghanistan are going to end up either dead or in a prison camp.
Yeah, mincemeat, basically. Anyway, so obviously next door to Iran, Afghanistan. You're quite right. If it kicks off, those British and American troops would have been horrendously exposed there. So, I mean, this is around about 2 weeks old, I think, or 10 days old. So maybe you should have done it last week, but we're in a very busy show. Let's have a listen now to one of your favourites, Martin. It's the Saker talking to Roger Waters about Palestine, because that's where we were saying earlier on the focus might now move. And, you know, I always think about it as the Eye of Sauron, I'm afraid, which is this kind of swivelling eye that looks around the world. Right, Afghanistan is over. Where are we going next? So this is Roger Waters, the Pink Floyd writer, singer, songwriter, etc., talking to the Saker. If you want to say a little bit about the Saker before we hear this, who the Saker is?
Well, I mean, people can go to his blog, Vineyard of the Saker. I mean, I don't know what his real name is. He doesn't tell anybody. He's got a Russian background, so he's originally Russian.
Although he lives in Florida, I think. Yes, he was a military advisor at the UN.
He lives in the US, but he's got Russian genetics, if you like.
Anyway, so let's have a listen now to this interesting conversation between one of Martin's favourite geopolitical analysts from around the world, and that's somebody I've interviewed on this show, actually, as well, and this chappie from Pink Floyd has been so vocal in supporting Julian Assange, talking about Palestine.
The world is paying more attention than it did 15 years ago when I got involved. I'm not saying it's because I got involved, but it just is. Attitudes have changed very fundamentally, particularly in the United States, where I live, I suggest. But there is support all over the world. You can now see it dotted everywhere you look. There are groups of people supporting the Palestinian cause in Canada, but also in Germany, all over. You know, even though the governments in France and Germany and the UK and all these other Western European countries are all solidly and firmly in the apartheid supporting Israeli camp, which is pretty weird that they are, but they are for all sorts of reasons that we don't completely understand. But the people are changing fundamentally. So 10 years ago, you could not use the word apartheid in a conversation about the occupation of Palestinian land. Yeah. Now you can't have a conversation about it without using the word apartheid, because so many bodies have now joined forces and come out and now and completely recognize that Israel and that Zionism is an apartheid endeavor. It's an apartheid endeavor of settler colonialism. And then they wouldn't agree with that, obviously, they don't. But most of the human rights organizations, so Human Rights Watch and B'Tselem, obviously, which is an Israeli organization, and Amnesty and people, they all agree now that this is an apartheid state. And the criticisms that were appended during the years from the 70s to the 90s to the Union of South Africa apply even more so. You know, it's a worse situation in the occupied parish. So people have come round to a different point. Will they ever get any human rights? It remains to be seen. Because that's fundamentally what it's about. It's saying if you care about human rights.
But the problem is that if you look at all the human rights organizations like B'Tselem and all the official position, they all recognize the two-state solution. And in my personal opinion, this smacks of more of the same.
Yeah, well, but no, they don't all anymore. But there are many freer thinkers than the people. A lot of the organizations that have actually done great work, BDS, which I'm a big supporter of, they've been very careful over the years to say that, they don't pick a one-state solution or a two-state solution or whatever, but they're basically like I am saying, we have to decide as a global community at some point whether we actually care about the fundamental idea of human rights.
or no?
It's been handed down to us since the Enlightenment. But if you even if you go back to 1789 to the French Revolution, you know, the idea that individual human beings have rights, okay, not just God and the king and one or two Mark Zuckerbergs, but everybody has basic rights. And that, and you either believe that to be true or you don't. I do. I think it's extremely important because it's the only way that we can prevent Mark Zuckerberg destroying. I mean, he's not doing it on his own, obviously, but to prevent the ruling class from completely destroying the planet so it's uninhabitable, not just for human beings, but for all life, will be, disappear very, very quickly if we don't accept the idea that the other person has human rights as well as us. This is what the Israelis find so difficult to do. And that if we don't accept that and don't act collectively to using our love to encompass all our brothers and sisters of the world, we will destroy it. We are destroying it. We will continue to do so, and it'll be gone, and that'll be the end of it.
Yeah.
You know, and it won't be any point you and me sitting there and going, "Oh, I told you so," because it'll be f-ing gone, and there, it won't be there for our grandchildren or their children. Right? It'll be gone.
That's an awareness that you have, and I think it's in our generation because of the Cold War, but I am getting often very discouraged. I don't see much of a peace movement anymore. I don't see a real left anymore. It's like they've been all co-opted into this one insipid media-presented reality.
Yeah.
You think we still have, is there still a, you know, a potential peace movement, a potential anti-apartheid movement out there?
You know, yes, there is. There is. Because I see that as well, but I agree with you about when you look at the status quo and when you look at the ruling class and look at it, the power it has to produce governments that have no interest at all in human
at all
or in democracy or in any kind of liberty or freedom for anybody. All they care about is commerce and the profit margins for the ruling classes. That's all it's about. And in consequence, some of the things that you see happening, like in the UK, for instance, that the Labour Party is now expelling most of my close friends. They expel them on the grounds that they're anti-Semites, but actually they're expelling them because they believe in the Labour movement.
Yeah.
And the Labour Party, Keir Starmer couldn't give a f- about the working class, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Of course.
It's just, you know, he's just another privileged. So I understand your concerns, but I have to say that I do see hope. I see hope in the fact that, you know, it's a funny thing. If you could, what we should be saying really is, if they lock Julian Assange up in the United States and kill him, which is what they're trying to do, that will be a huge backward step, obviously, for everybody.
Oh, yes.
Because it will say, what it will say is that we, Homo sapiens, the peoples of the world, stood by silent and indifferent. Eli Wiesel, the only sort of wise thing that he ever said, you know, who wrote Night, after he survived Auschwitz and all of that stuff. But he said words to the effect, to stand by silent and indifferent is the greatest sin of all.
Yeah.
And he meant that it was a huge sin if you did it while the Germans were gassing the Jews. But he doesn't seem to think it's quite such a big sin when the Israelis are murdering the Palestinians.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you have to say, hey, Eli, if I could get hold of him, he's probably dead now. If he's not, he's 110 years old, but whatever. And sort of shake him a bit and say, don't you get it? It has to be for everybody. It cannot just be for the Jews.
So that's Roger Waters there, talking to the Seiko about the problems in in the Middle East, particularly between Iran and Israel and the Palestinians suffering. But actually what he's also describing there, Martin, is this home front in that battle, which is being commandeered and commanded by Keir Starmer, really just simply removing pro-Palestinians from the Labour Party.
Well, Starmer is not the only. There is clearly an issue with the Labour Party, but you've also got the conservative friends of Israel, Labour friends of Israel. They dominate. Many of our politicians from across the spectrum are, in fact, basically pro-Zionist.
Well, this is APAC in the UK, isn't it? Yeah. The American Israeli Public Affairs Committee, which is very, very well funded, and just makes sure that senators and Congress people that are standing for election all support the Israel in this conflict.
Well, there's a very good article by Jonathan Cook, who's British journalist based
another
in
one. Almost everything by him is very good.
Well, yeah, but it's about the Jewish Chronicle here, which was basically a failing magazine. You know, it was basically going to go bust, and it's been rescued by various secretive billionaire supporters, and it's had 28. It's lost 4 libel cases and had 28 decisions against it in the press complaints body in the last 3 years. But at the same time, these people it's pursuing its function of sabotaging all, basically conflating anti-Israeli government politics with anti-Semitism. And there's no real body. They've lost 4 libel cases and they've lost quite a lot of money. But the people backing them have said, "Don't worry about that. We'll cover it." So that's what we're up against.
It's just money, isn't it? The controlling the printing presses, but also big battle going on here in Bristol, which is an attempt to sack one of the world's greatest sociologists. That's David Miller. Professor David Miller here at Bristol University. In fact, when I first came across him, he was up at Strathclyde University in Glasgow. Very kindly invited me up there to speak about the Bilderbergers, must be a decade ago now, to some of his students and discuss who this interesting lobby was, which was a fascinating chat. A load of really, really interesting, very interesting questions from those students. And then he moved to Bath University, and then he came closer and closer. He's into Bristol. It's almost as if he's been moved in for the kill, Martin, there.
Well, Bristol University is more prestigious than the other two.
Is it? Is it really prestigious?
Hang on.
Apparently, right. So, as far as I understand it, Bristol University is where the dim toffs go.
That's right, but there's more.
So the ones that can't get into Oxford and Cambridge.
Well, that is the gossip. But of course, I mean, the fact is that he's a very high ranking academic, and he's done loads of interesting work. And of course, he's now, the attempt to remove him from his job for saying stuff. I mean, even if the stuff he'd said was wrong.
Let's just be clear about what he said, right? Yeah. Which is that the Union of Jewish Students is working for the Israeli state. Well, he's showing through the financial connections that is the case, that they're not actually there representing Jews, they're there representing Israel. Why is this such an important difference?
Well, the Union of Jewish Students doesn't represent all Jewish students in Britain, first point, yeah? And the Union of Jewish Students, in its constitution, calls for the support for the State of Israel as fundamental to what the Union of Jewish Students is about. Now, I haven't got a problem with that. You can have an organisation in universities called the Union of Jewish Students, which has got a pro-Israeli stance. But then you can't, by the same token, say other people, there'll be something called the Union of Palestinian Students, and they won't have a pro-Israeli stance. And that's what student life is supposed to be about, isn't it?
Okay, this is Tony Greenstein's blog, and I'll put a link up to this on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, discussing the hearing about David Miller by Bristol University, which is due to take place next week. I feel actually like I'm in a sort of similar situation with the National Union of Journalists, which is attempting to have me removed. Well, the union isn't. Some of its members, under what's called the Rule 24, where I made comments about Roman Protasevich, saying that he could be potentially a spook rather than a journalist. Well, someone called Simon Pirani has decided that this is a reason to get rid of me from the National Union of Journalists because I'm bringing the union into disrepute. I feel rather similar, obviously much lower level individual than David Miller. But, you know, this what's happening is the same principle, is that various people who are supportive of the Palestinians around the UK are, as part of this war that is potentially going to happen fairly soon in the Middle East, being just removed as part of the home front. But, for example, the Board of Deputies of British Jews, Tony Greenstein on his blog has posted that. His in the letters to the Bristol University leaked to Tony, and his actual headline is, and it was, this was out just 2 days ago, that's Wednesday, exclusive Bristol University hearing into David Miller's right of freedom of speech will take place next week as the Zionist campaign to dismiss him intensifies, and no doubt the Union of British Students will be calling Tony Greenstein a self-hating Jew.
They will, no doubt. But I think there are some fundamental questions here. I mean, academic freedom supposedly allows you to say pretty much, and the government are just passing a law to say that you can't stop people saying stuff in universities. What they want that law to is to protect, for example, people like David Irving, who was you know, the Holocaust denier and so on. And of course they say, but it won't allow for Holocaust denial. Okay. But anybody who criticizes the state of Israel, I mean, what the Union of Jewish Students says, they don't feel safe in university with David Miller there because he doesn't like them. And it's like, well, yes, but you do support the state of Israel.
He's exposing
don't you?
Their yes, political do. Links and their funding.
Yes. I mean, the fact is, and I don't know what they're complaining about. They openly say that they are there to campaign for the Israeli state. We're in favor of the state of Israel. And that's okay. I've got nothing to argue about. They're entitled to their view. But other people are not going to be in favour of the state of Israel. Are they entitled to their view? And of course, it's not about them feeling safe. It's actually because they're being put up to this, and this is pretty much what David Miller has said, by the Israeli embassy. And no doubt they meet people from the embassy all the time, that let's get Miller, and that's what they're doing. And of course, it's rather disgusting that the Bristol University authorities are going on along with this, because they should just be saying, tough, you know, you can say what you like and he can say what he likes. That's it.
Yeah, I mean, the idea that he's somehow anti-Semitic, he has been actually over the years one of the best analysts of anti-Muslim bias in the British press. Nobody pretty much has done such a good job in explaining all that to the British public. Not that the people like the BBC ever really much listen, but he's done an extremely good job in showing that the British press over the years has been horrendously Islamophobic. And that's obviously part of all of this. So,
yes, it is.
The other thing is that this won't be the end of things. There's likely to be a some sort of appeal, and also employment tribunal. Well, let's see what happens next week. And that's why Tony Greenstein has been flagging this up, that this decision will be made next week. At least that's what he's been told. Anyway, our final item this evening is a really sad announcement, I'm afraid. It's the death of Barry Wynn. Barry is a former SAS soldier. He was blown across a main road during the tail end of World War II by a V2 and survived that. And he worked for ATV Television, doing the public relations work for the Avengers program, the original Avengers, including that one with Dinah Rigg, who also died not long ago. But Barry had retired out to Cyprus, and I came across him, I think it would be roughly about 2016, to do some fascinating interviews with him. And really, his book is called The King's Shilling, and it's available from, I think, Amazon, etc. And I read that. I found it absolutely unputdownable, because he also then went on to take part in the Malaya campaign, and he talks very entertainingly and rivetingly about what it was like to be a soldier out in Malaya, and also trying to do the right thing. You know, you've got various factions fighting. The other thing, of course, was that the Chinese were there, also trying to take over Malaya at the time. But one of the most fascinating aspects of this, I did interview Barry about back in 2016, which was that his father, who was working as doing procurement and purchasing for a big department store in Oxford Street was buttonholed by the senior military in Britain at the beginning of the Second World War, and said, we need someone who knows how to move things around the world because we know there's going to be a big fight in North Africa. And of course, this ended up being the first real battle the British won before the US entered the war. That is the Battle of El Alamein. And his father was the one who was in charge of getting all the equipment over to North Africa to win that battle.
In North Africa, we had some brilliant generals, Wavell, Allenby, and people like that. But lack of supplies, everything difficult, huge areas to cover, and they needed, Churchill needed, and guided by Alan Brooke, needed a new team out there, because we were basically in a very powerless state from morale. Everybody was depressed, been beaten many times, but they were pretty brilliant in what they did because they didn't have enough men and didn't have the right equipment. And the German equipment was far superior to ours. So Churchill, on the advice from his military people, said, we've got to have a new team. They decided to appoint Alexander as the GOC, and they, in fact, then appointed a man called Gott to be the field commander. But he was killed within 3 weeks of being appointed. So there was another crisis. Who on earth do we replace that key position? And Allenbrooke said, there is one man we've got to do. There's only one man to do this, Montgomery. Now, the interesting thing to me, because after all, I was very young then, was that the two commanders now appointed had both been battalion commanders in the First World War. They knew better than anybody else what we were up against with the German army. More efficient, ruthless in their way, and that something special would be needed to do this. So Montgomery said, yes, well, I will accept the task, but only on one condition. I'm not prepared to start an attack or do anything else until I am given the right number of men, the right number of units, the support of the Royal Air Force, and the supplies. And if I say I want 10,000 shells of so-and-so, I shall require 30,000. If you do that for me, I will give you victory. That's basically what he said. And Churchill said, I agree with you. Okay. That's what we would do. So my father was on the supply field. It was terrifically difficult to send all these supplies right across the Atlantic to escape from the U-boats, down the coast, the east coast of America, down through South America, then across to Africa, then up the other side of Africa. Everything had to come in this huge distance, being harassed by U-boats all the way. So the supply situation was absolutely extraordinary. And I remember in my book, A King Shilling, that my father said 500 lorry loads of food and supplies would be gone in one day to keep the army going. And thousands of miles of desert highways, Stuka bombers and heaven knows what. And of course, the Battle of Alamein, and another very interesting thing, it was the last defence before Egypt. Now, when Alexander took over and Montgomery, Alexander was a sort of an aristocratic man, always perfectly turned out. He was the epitome of the British officer. Charming, perfectly dressed and everything else. You could underestimate him. But he would delegate everything to Montgomery. So the thing is this, here we had the backs to the wall. There was the Suez Canal, only a few miles away. This new team comes in. Morale of the British Army was at the lowest possible ebb. We thought we were going to be defeated because Rommel, the brilliant general that he was, thought, right, we're right on top of this, break through the Suez Canal, we then get the oil. We then go further east and we will attack the Russians from the rear through the Crimea. That would have been fatal. So they had to be stopped at the last point. So when Montgomery came, he didn't choose that position. The position was already chosen. But when Alexander went into the headquarters of Africa, he saw all his key officers, brigadiers, colonels and generals and one thing and another, working on papers and this and that, and they were furious intent. And he sort of big new broom said, well, what are you working on? They said, well, we're working on for when we're going to go the other side of the Suez Canal and use that as our last defence. Alexander said, gentlemen, tear up those papers. There is no further defeat. There is no further retreat. We will stand here and die if it's necessary. Do you understand? Well, within 3 weeks, they say, the whole morale of the Eighth Army changed. It was the right thing to do at the time. So, in other words, no more retreat. A wonderful position we were in. Now, how do we deal with this? How do we defeat Rommel? And that is really what happened. And the main thing was the equipment and the supplies. The wonderful people we had there. I mean, we talk now about Scotland. The most wonderful fighting men to have beside you. You don't have to worry whether they'd still be there. The New Zealanders were excellent. And the Australians. And the Indians. We were all there. But now everybody knew. Right. Apparently this is the end. So we better damn well do something about it. And that to me is a, you know, I still think, I mean, it wasn't the biggest battle by long chalk. I mean, the Russians took far more trouble. They had, you know, battles with 3,000 tanks at a time. I mean, dreadful things. But the pivotal change really was Alamein. And it was the last battle in which we didn't have the Americans. We did it as the British Empire. And, of course, it was successful. And Churchill was so nervous about it. But when they finally said, yes, we've done it, he wanted to be absolutely certain before he gave the order, ring out the bells of England.
So, that's the voice of Barry Wynn, who has just died. Barry, more, I think, a little bit more from him next week, because he told me an incredible story about having lunch with a chap called Colonel Pinto, who's an intelligence officer that discovered that there was a spy, or he believed he was a spy, who was about to be secreted into Holland just before Operation Market Garden, the film A Bridge Too Far, in order to tell the Germans all about the British plans, go straight to the Abwehr. But that was a key little piece of the jigsaw that Barry gave me in and uncovering the origins of the Bilderberg conferences, which I've now put together in my book, The Traitors of Arnhem. So that is now time to sign off. Thanks very much to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Also to sound engineer Dave Bazanko. Maybe I should say that twice, actually, Dave, because I forgot last week. To be included on my weekly email circulation list, please email me at tony@cultureshop.org.uk. That address is on the contact tab at the show page, which has got the podcast story links and comment page at thisweek.org.uk. If you've got a site or a story or a video you'd like to share, you think there's anything I've missed or I've got a correction, please do email me with a link or two, even a scan of what you've got if possible. You can download our MP3s and you can listen in the car or anywhere you like off that show page, this week, one word, .org.uk, or off Radio 4 All. I'm shadow banned on Twitter at Tony Gosling. This show's repeated at 11 p.m. on Fridays and at 11:05 a.m. and p.m. all week, apart from when the Richie Allen show is on here on the PRSC stream, and over Sunday lunch at Camberley's Glorious Radio QUK.com. Do feel free, please, to make live recordings of the stream. We have been streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokescroft in Bristol and, of course, at RadioQUK.com in Camberley, Surrey. Censorship and self-censorship of life-saving information is sadly the norm in the UK today, thanks to the collaborators who own the transmitters and the printing presses, the glorious Fourth Reich. So, if you can restream us live or rebroadcast, just let me know and we'll credit you here. Here's wishing you a relaxing an enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show live stream, 5 p.m. next Friday. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.